Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotric are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotric.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60, and I thank Velotric for being a sponsor on this show. This means we are live, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions. Welcome to another episode of Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the, had to hitch breath, on the SGGQA podcast channel. I was trying to make it, see how far I can make it in one breath, and I didn't plan ahead this morning. Hey, everybody, welcome to an earlier broadcast because daylight savings time is a thing. We sprung ahead over the weekend. Everybody in the house is grumpy, off in the distance, sirens, you know, the entire cavalcade of terrible life decisions that we just seem to keep going along with because of momentum and reasons, and we can't ever seem to find the fortitude to change. So, if you're catching this internationally, this is a little early for you. If you're catching this on the replay crew, always appreciate my replay crew, then this is gonna be probably the same. So, welcome. We had a lovely weekend. First, like 2 days in a row here in Southern California where we didn't have like gross, gray, rainy weather. We got out there, we caught up, we had to play a couple makeup games for my daughter's softball team. I was out there shooting photos. I've been able to shoot photos again in nice, bright California sunshine. And just also, our neighborhood is so nice after it gets a washing, you know, you take a shower and it's all nice and fresh. So, Grounded Tech, everyone in the house is a grumpy butt just because. That is absolutely our house to a T. It was so sad. So, the girls' softball team, Saturday wasn't daylight savings. We transferred between Saturday and Sunday. The Saturday game, everyone's bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, feeling fresh. Sunday, every family, every girl just trudging to the field. No one is happy. So, yeah, it would be nice if we could finally abolish this travesty of a let's just arbitrarily change time during the year thing. It's pretty dumb. So, yeah, it's always bad, and anyone who ever defends it or is apathetic to it is automatically incorrect. We have a really news-heavy show this week. And again, like, I've got some stuff here that I'm working on for the tech side. We can always chat about other devices and stuff, or if we just want to do follow-ups, or if you want to ask questions, we can kind of populate the gadget block. But this is definitely a news block that's going to run long, and my voice is still kind of healing. So we're really going to try, especially since I'm technically up an hour earlier than I usually am, we're technically going to try to not run this into being a three-hour show. I always say that, and I always fail, but we're going to try. We're going to try to try. So we're already seeing an incredible group here in the chat. So many folks, so many friendly faces. JMan150, TNC, John Gao saying, happy Monday, folks. Dave Burns, Lampras, Delandbit, Ranesh, Grounded Tech, Jermaine, what's up, Jermaine? Barry Johnson, Vazikos, Ron Guido, Blue Man Rule, just saying good morning all, Matt Klein, Kapakosh, we've got, oh no, I'm missing people, I always hate it when I feel like I'm missing people, I know there were others in the chat, I apologize if I did not call out your name, Otaku, if I did not call out your name, Romper Room style, I don't even know if people get that reference when I say Romper Room. Romper Room was even a little before my time, so I wouldn't blame you. We've got Malik, we've got Bionic Scoop. All right. J-Man150 challenge accepted. I can guarantee you it'll be a show that's very close to 3 hours. LOL. All right. The gauntlet has been thrown down. We're going to see. I'm going to try and keep us on task. So last week for Pajama Podcast, we didn't really do the whole spiel. So we got some housekeeping that we definitely need to dig into. It was a pretty busy week, and I'm trying to find ways to flesh out sort of what I'm doing on my YouTube channel. And I've had a lot of very serious and dour conversations with other content creators sort of in the mid-pack. So there are a number of us out there like me. You'll maybe see me as a gun for hire on another channel or writing up editorials or doing some sort of freelance work across the web. But for my own personal stuff, I'm sort of medium tier, right? I've got a pretty healthy YouTube channel. It's growing sort of at a consistent pace, if not, it's not an exciting pace, but a lot of folks in my mid-pack, we're really not having a good time. So this is not going to be the time where I air all of my dirty laundry. Oh, Dr. Claw, Romper Room, a Burt Claster production, Hasbro. sorry, it just caught my eye. So, I got a lot of stuff out, but I'm really wanting to get back into tech talks and tips and tricks and content that isn't just phone review after phone review after phone review. So one of the late videos from last week was phone cameras rock, but we need better audio. I did a quick walk and talk vlog, just shifting back and forth between two of my all-time favorite camera phones, one of which is over there. Oh, I can't reach it. It's like, I need telekinesis. The Vivo X100 Pro I'm actually using to shoot a video, and it's over on my crappy little IKEA desk over there. But the other one is, of course, my Xiaomi 13 Ultra. And I hooked up some wireless mics, took them for a walk around the neighborhood, and literally just moving the mic back and forth. And again, it's like one of those conversations where I take certain things for granted that people understand what I'm doing, and I absolutely should not have. I've been in the comments on that video just replying to people like, no, it's the same mic. I'm using the same microphone. I'm just switching the phone. No, these aren't the phone microphones. I'm not complaining about the phone. Like, the microphones on both phones are great microphones. What we're talking about is the process. It's like I've got to go all the way. This is one of the things that burned me out about being some audio guy, is I would write up this really in-depth, like, here's an examination. This is what, you know, like, polar patterns do to the sound of the human voice. And then I would publish it and would get a little spike of traffic. And people would be like, great, what an awesome educational resource. And then like 6 months later, I would get a targeted question from someone that was answered in that editorial. But if I tried to point them to that editorial, they wouldn't read it. They would just be like, no, but for me, my question is this. And you're like, yeah, your question is answered in that article. I read the article. But I have something specific that I need to ask you. And then they would ask me, it's like, that's answered in the article. So it's like when I start talking about audio concepts, like, oh, I've been talking about audio on the internet for 20 years. Maybe it's not fair that someone hasn't kept up with me talking about microphones for 20 years, might have a question. Maybe I need to settle myself down. Back to some housekeeping. We also had a pretty fun little announcement come out. The Soundcore Boom 2 is now available for, I don't know if it's actually shipping yet. I think it's in kind of a pre-order state. There are like coupon codes and fun things that you can like shop it. It's a very inexpensive speaker. We talked about it a little on Thursday's Best of Our Week. Waterproof, rugged. Oh, sorry, not just waterproof, it floats. And it's also gotten a sort of a power upgrade, taking it really close to last year's Motion Boom Plus. So the littler speaker from Soundcore is now about as powerful as the bigger speaker from Soundcore used to be. So really fun video to put together. Really enjoyed working with the folks at Soundcore just to kind of highlight all the new features and what was coming out. And it's still shocking to me that what you think is a very simple appliance accessory, a wireless Bluetooth speaker, has kind of grown into its own series of different like solutions, portability, ruggedness, stuff like that. And you can make a better purchasing decision on, is this something that's going to live in a bedroom, or is this something I need to clip to like a hiking backpack? Where are we with these different options? But right now it does seem to be a pretty fun race between JBL and Soundcore for these like big radiator subwoofer driven portable thump machines, like skull rumblers, but from a distance. Yeah, JMAN150, yeah, and I think it's also El Jefe approved. Yeah, Jeff also got to take a spin with it too. I will always highlight, I am your friend when you want to talk about detail, articulation, audio in the mids, clarity, that kind of stuff. Jeff is your dude if you want to cut to the chase and you want to find, like, is this... What does he say? Is it bass head approved? For me, it's like, is this the option I would recommend for skull rumblers? Right? Is like, if you want to rattle the fillings out of your teeth, I trust Jeff's ears better than mine. If you're talking about like a specific kind of like clarity or articulation, then that's my bag. That's what I like to try and accomplish. Hold on one second. My doorbell is ringing. Oh, my wife rang the doorbell, but then she found her key. Okay, everything's fine. Everything's fine. Everything's good. My wife is not locked out of the house. It's like we're doing it live. It's live podcasting. I love it. And so this is the other kind of thing is like, I've really tried to hone who I think my audience is, and I'm trying to have conversations at a tier that I would like to talk about this stuff. Not just, oh, two cameras and I shot these photos side by side, but obviously one is better composed than the other photo. I put together just a quick and dirty examination of the Xiaomi 14 Ultra, the Xiaomi 14, the little Xiaomi 14, and how it's rocking this new OmniVision camera sensor. It's a 1 over 1.3 inch type sensor. Which, if we're paying attention to phones like Apple, like the iPhone 15 Pro and the Galaxy S24 Ultra, the most expensive phones from Apple and Samsung have a sensor that's roughly, a main camera sensor that's roughly in this size tier. Now, the littler, oh, do I actually have that still on my desk? Yeah, I still have it on my desk. The littler Xiaomi 14 is now stepping up directly to the main camera sensor on the S24 Ultra. And not only are they sort of comparable in size, OmniVision is doing some really cool stuff to expand on the light gathering capabilities of this sensor. Now, again, I take some things for granted that maybe you've been following conversations about optics and camera sensors and HDR processing, and I'm throwing out things like there's an expanded ISO range. And of course, I've got a comment coming back like, well, that's not what's important. If the, you know, ISO is just a measurement, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, that's correct. Thank you for being pedantic. I'm not saying ISO range in a vacuum and just showing you numbers from a spec sheet. I'm putting two photos side by side. And if we're saying that this is the total range of the light sensitivity on the Galaxy, well, then in that same range, the OmniVision is outperforming it, and you've got two stops further to go. But this isn't what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is what you said is that ISO is this. It's like, yeah, but then there was like three more minutes of video. So you have the reading comprehension, or I guess the listening comprehension of an angry hamster. Well, I gotta get another drink of coffee. Oh no, darn, I thought we were gonna get a live unboxing. If I had the 14 Ultra, I would absolutely hop into a live stream just to show it off. I think Xiaomi is going to be very conservative with its distribution. The numbers of those phones going out, it's a halo product, the most expensive phone they sell. And unfortunately, I bet you that means that when it comes to reviewers, like especially at my tier, it's probably only going to go to a handful of reviewers. They will want to see the largest immediate impact, even if it means the video is exposed to millions of people with a conclusion like, yeah, but I mean, I guess it's pretty good. I don't know, guys. What do you think? Would you trade in your iPhone for this camera phone? And then the conclusion, the assumed conclusion will be, it's good, but who would really buy it? And they want to see huge numbers on those videos. They don't care about sort of the practical, actual assessment or the longevity of the conversation where, I mean, like, I still hold up and put the Xiaomi 13 Ultra in my videos. That's not what they really care about. But yeah, if I don't know. I'm really looking at budget because we're starting to get some hot, like, anticipation and rumors and leaks and benchmarks coming out for the Windows on ARM laptops. And I gotta spend some time with Windows on ARM. So I probably will not be spending a lot of money on all of the ultra tier phones this year. Yeah. Oh, Jermaine, if you do, like, let me know if you grab the 14 Ultra, man, and I'll help hype whatever you're talking about. But I might need to sit it out. There's just so much going on. I have the A-roll shot, and my voice is just haggard, so I might actually reshoot the whole video. But I still need to finish my Vivo X100 Pro full sort of conclusive camera examination. There's so much going on. It's good. It's good to have this problem, but man, I'm exhausted. So those were the biggies, just kind of like trying to get commentary out and not just sort of a buy a blueprint kind of review. I do want to highlight this too, because I mentioned it and it kind of went quiet on me. But in the benchmarking side over on Patreon, the patreon.com/somegadgetguy, Xiaomi 14, Galaxy S24 Ultra, and Vivo V30 Pro by the benchmarks. And I took the time to run those three phones, add them to my charts. So I can scroll down a little bit here. So when we go down, you can kind of, I didn't actually click on it. There we go. See, when you open the article, then you can read what's in the article. But yeah, so just from phones to kind of show improvements over time, and then I always include like an older phone, like an LG V50, like a Snapdragon 855. And so we're kind of looking at a handful of Dimensities and a handful of Snapdragons, and just where we kind of end up with performance in real world apps. So it's always interesting to me. We start seeing this like, oh, well, I mean, it's not that big of a deal. The Dimensity 9300 only got like a 10% better score in Geekbench and multi-core, blah, blah, blah. And then you really run that chip through an app you can run on your phone, and the score is like a 30 or 40% difference. And you're like, well, don't you think you would care if you bought one of the most expensive phones on the market? And you compared it with another of the most expensive phones on the market, that there was like a 40% performance difference. I feel like we've completely let down actual enthusiasts in the tech commentary space. I know phones have been relegated to this obligatory pocket appliance idea that, oh, all you're going to do is like scan your TikTok on it. But it's because we don't show the real ramifications of this stuff that I feel like it just reinforces the laziest notion of what a phone might be. And yet, I'll go and find people like, hey, I've got this busted 4-year-old mid-ranger and I'm shooting these kind of like cinematic style TikToks on it. And you're like, that's awesome. There's someone actually doing something with their phones. That's someone who deserves to own one of the nicer phones, not someone who's like, but average consumers, you know, they just want to show that they spent a lot of money. And you're like, all right, I know I can't make videos for those people. So that's kind of the current slate of commentary on the channel right now. I've got reviews that I really need to finish up. I'm still working with a couple of clients, just trying to get some sponsored content out. And it's been interesting. It's been interesting kind of like putting these pieces together, because I've got things like I'm reviewing some wireless mics. And the prototype that they sent me, they don't work. But I had to go through the entire rigmarole. Well, did you try unplugging and plugging them back in? And you're like, this is going to take so long. And you know what? After a point, do I just tell my audience that these things don't work? Or can you maybe just send me a different unit and then we'll immediately get to see if there are differences in operation? And it's just so time consuming because I've got to go and shoot all these samples. I've got to do all these tests. I've got to set all this stuff up. And you're like, you didn't send me something that works. It's really bad for you if you send me something that doesn't work. And then it takes so long. So it's frustrating because, like, the press releases are already out. The first wave of videos are already out. So all of that time is basically wasted. What little interest there might have been in the announcement of a new product is gone. And I need to impress upon them, like, now I'm coming to this late. It's really bad for my YouTube channel to not be, like, immediately on the pulse. But that's a YouTube thing. I shouldn't punish the manufacturer, but they sent me something that's broken. Oh, it's so frustrating. Geet Madden with a question here. With all the phones you have, do you ever have specific features that would reach, that you would reach for an older phone instead of something after 2020? Headphone port doesn't count. Of course, the headphone jack counts, because regularly you should be picking up LG phones to be media players. The second life of an LG is to be one of the best portable media players on the planet, dollar to performance. You can absolutely find dApps that will outperform an LG V30 or an LG V50, but they'll cost you four or five times more. The LG V50 is still a regular in my lineup because it is still one of the all-time best audio processing phones that we've ever seen. The microphones aren't quite as good as what we had on old Nokia devices, but the phone takes a very hands-off approach to processing the audio coming in. The G8 and the LG V60 were the complete opposite. So any audio that phone detects in recording in the audio recorder app or in the camera app immediately gets mangled by their noise reduction and voice enhancement tools. And there's no way for you to turn it off, or at least no easy way for you to turn it off and still use the features of the phone. So the V50 is kind of a golden solution for doing things like podcasting on the go and having a good mic input on the headphone jack and a great amp to monitor off of that headphone amp. And it doesn't matter. You plug in USB audio, you plug in 3.5 millimeter audio, you're recording into something like Audio Evolution. The LG V50 for a while was even replacing the little mini portable recorders that I would use. So yeah, there are still regularly times. It's funny, like on Threads, I kind of bumped into someone who's just kind of all about old specialty phones, and he was talking about tracking down a BlackBerry Key 2. So just for a day over the weekend, I was playing around with my Key 2. You know, you bring it out and you realize, like, well, it's funny, you bring out a BlackBerry and you start typing on the keyboard again, and it's alien for about an hour. It's like, oh, wait, yeah, I've got to get to the alts. Oh, there's my numbers. These are all the symbols, but I need other symbols. Oh, that's right. The symbol button's going to pop up on the screen. It's not on the keyboard. And then after about an hour of struggling, I'm typing and I'm not even thinking about it. And I miss so badly the tactile thumb board experience. And that we keep doing this thing like, oh, don't you remember when phones were fun and wacky? But you go back to that time period, and all the people who are so nostalgic about, oh, the wacky phones were the first ones to be like, it's not good enough. These wacky phones, I mean, I guess if you need the novelty, that's fine. And you're like, man, we used to have so much more fun. So people in the chat, as we were getting into the broadcast, were saying, hey, how's your foot? My foot actually is still kind of hurting. I was using the Tank. This is the Tank 3 Pro. It is an absurd appliance of a communications gadget. It's not a good phone, but it is a Swiss Army knife of every other feature we've ever maybe thought we'd want on a portable computing device. And I was shooting with it, and you would think it's so big and it's so broad. It is easy to hold on to, but I was trying to like move it. I'm almost going to drop it again. I was trying to move it from shooting a photo into holding it as a phone in one hand, and I was crouching, and it slid, and it hit the top of my foot. My instinct was to try and catch it with my foot instead of letting it hit the dirt. Because you never know. There's like a little rock, and it hits the screen. Even with this being a ruggedized device, it's a big screen. I should have let it hit the dirt. That thing hurt. I dropped a 20,000 milliamp hour power bank wrapped around a phone in a ruggedized waterproof case with a built-in projector and an active cooling fan. That's so much mass to have in a phone. Yeah, that did not feel good. So I was limping for a day. I'm back to just sort of walking, but the top of my foot when I lace up my shoelaces, like, ow, oh, that kind of stings. So there will be a video out on that this week, especially now that I can get out and maybe get some nice daylight shots of it, not in pouring torrential rain. So it's funny. I really wish we still could talk about novelty and we could focus a little more broadly on some of these differences, like being able to say, like, hey, this is not going to be the iPhone killer everyone wants to see in some kind of showdown, but it is purpose-built for a specific audience, and they need to know it exists. So we need to signal boost whenever there's a smaller demographic phone. Instead, you've got a bunch of tryhards out there who love the taste of Samsung and Apple boots, immediately rushing to, this is why it's different than an iPhone, so you shouldn't buy it. And that is the death of our hobby. It's really looking dire out there. It's really rough. And again, Google reinforces this with the way that they ratchet popularity metrics for medium-sized channels like mine. So we've got so much news to dig into. Everything that we're going to be talking about, my housekeeping, all of the articles, all of the show notes will be on the blog post for this week's episode on somegadgetguide.com. And actually, while I bring up things like my personal website, somegadgetguide.com, and my Patreon, patreon.com/somegadgetguy, one of the articles that we're going to be talking about is this ratcheting of social media and how all of our internet points basically mean nothing for your favorite content creators. And it feels like we're doing this work and we're supporting them and we're getting people out there and we're getting people engaged, but basically there's zero correlation between someone doing well on social media and actually succeeding in life. Again, the news is pretty dark, has been really dark over the last couple weeks. Carl, you're not wrong though. Juan needs some steel toe boots when he's carrying that Unihertz around. The physical toll. I have gotten some ridiculous injuries while being a tech reviewer. Throwing out my back, setting up an electric bike, dropping the Unihertz tank on my foot. It's really silly. It is a really silly way to try and make a living, and it's even sillier when you hurt yourself doing it. So it's pretty great. All right, getting into the news block. A lot of these are follow-ups. So we've talked recently about TikTok. We've got a follow-up here. This is John Brodkin over at Ars Technica, my super nerd man crush. And oh, I don't know if I set up my screen share properly. Hold on one sec. Yeah, okay, it is. It's showing this right. So, U.S. lawmakers vote 50-0 to force sale of TikTok despite angry calls from users. Lawyer, TikTok must sever relationship with Chinese Communist Party. I am very torn on this because I feel there is some interesting chatter in the way that we're kind of going after TikTok. But I don't believe the conversation with TikTok is China bad. I think the conversation that we should be focusing on with TikTok is social media has been a raging dumpster fire that is bad for us. And we try to regulate things that are bad for us, but we're picking and choosing based on some notion of geopolitical borders. And that's not how the internet works. So anything that we can apply to TikTok is applicable to our relationship with Twitter, with Facebook, with YouTube. All of these things kind of function the same way, but because we can gin up a xenophobic China bad, China is, how do they phrase it? China is, hold on. I got to get into the actual... I should have actually read part of the article. I really want you to follow John Brodkin's work. I try not to spoil his articles. Because really, you should just set up an RSS feed for anything John Brodkin publishes. I've always loved his write-ups and how well-sourced and how well-organized they are. But it's like... it's not the entities list. Adversary. We are calling China an adversary over the weaponization of social media through apps and services like TikTok. We are using some of the most hostile foreign policy language in a bill that specifically references TikTok. Again, we're trying to craft laws that are not broadly applicable to all social media. We're trying to find what would hurt China in a law against ByteDance, which is trying to force a divestiture of TikTok from their current shareholders. It's kind of ludicrous. At the same time that the EU is crafting some of the most comprehensive consumer protection regulations, some of them are clumsy, but they're steps in the right direction on reining in big data, and we've got to work through the legalities of how we regulate trillion-dollar corporations. At the same time that the EU is proving to actually be somewhat effective in managing the interests of consumers and protecting their privacy rights by entrenching encryption, the United States government is going, China bad, ban TikTok. And I'm grossly oversimplifying for comedic effect because I want you to read the article, but this is kind of crazy. When we get into... Let me get into part of the article here, because the doublethink on this is very frustrating. Many users called lawmakers' offices to complain. Congressional staffers told Politico, quote, "It's so bad. It's so bad. Our phones have not stopped ringing. They're teenagers and old people saying they spend their whole day on the app and we can't take it away," one House GOP staffer was quoted as saying. House Commerce Committee Chair Kathy McMorris Rogers out of Washington said that TikTok enlisting users to call lawmakers showed, quote, "In real time, how the Chinese Communist Party can weaponize platforms like TikTok to manipulate the American people." So how do we have a conversation about free speech and democracy when we can then use the activation of people who care enough about this platform that they're trying to protect their access to it in a free speech society? And conservative lawmakers are saying, see, they're calling us to complain. That's evidence that China is manipulating the American people. Do we see how much of a cluster poop? I'm trying not to swear. Do we see how much of a mess we have created with this partial little reactionary, we dip our toe into regulating tech, but not for reals, because we want free business, a libertarian idea of business freedoms. But, you know, it's okay if Facebook destroys the fabric of our society and how we relate and talk to each other, but we're going to go after this one little, not little, we're going to go after this one specific app instead. And when people push back on that, that's the psychological manipulation of the app. So I feel we're not handling this as consistently as we could. I feel, there's a problem in how we're going about and doing this. It's a really bad look. So please read this article and all of John Brodkin's work. But I do believe we'll probably be following up on the TikTok situation in the weeks and months to come. So we should at least kind of keep an eye on where it's at right now. Let me get a drink. Oh, Malik, it's all that lobbying, right? Congress is worried about TikTok, yet some folks' pockets are lined by Meta and X. Hot take! I don't think that's too spicy of a hot take. I think that's pretty well known that we lobby our lawmakers. We're not lining their pockets. I mean, we're putting money in their pockets, so it's like lining, but it's totally different. This is totally above board. It's campaign contributions that influence that. Oh, no, we maybe don't want to say that. Dr. Claw, all of these social media companies vacuum up users' data, especially Meta and Twitter. The TikTok detractors are mad that their gatekeeping is being subverted by a Chinese app. I just feel if there is evidence of China as an adversary involved in the consumer side of businesses like TikTok or Huawei back in the day, then withholding the scope of the threat from the American people is a grossly irresponsible move from our country's law enforcement organizations. And if there is good data to suggest that there is an actual weaponized threat that is unique and different than what we see from companies like Apple and Samsung and Google, then it is on our law enforcement agencies to properly detail that to the other tech companies so that we have a better and a more measured response to protecting the American people. I still have not seen, and someone please correct me if this has popped up, I have still not seen good data as to why Huawei was removed from store shelves in the United States. That is different than Huawei not being used for telecommunications infrastructure. I'm talking about the phone a consumer holds, a Huawei Mate 10 Pro. I still have one over on my bookshelf. What evidence there may have been that that posed a security or a privacy threat, an anti-consumer threat to the citizens of the United States. I've put that out fairly bluntly. I keep getting these xenophobic, oh, but they always just steal all your data. And that if there's evidence of that, then we should be able to point to it on a web link in the internet zone. And I haven't had someone just say, go here, read this, and they did an audit of the security measures on the Huawei Mate 20. And great, I can read that white paper, that's a scientific study, and I can see how it compares with Samsungs and iPhones. And I don't think it's there. I've been asking, when did the Mate 10, is this 5 years? 5 years now? Is that where we're at? Six? Is it almost 6 years? I can't remember when the Mate 10 came out. My brain is Swiss cheese. Oh yeah, Kapakosh. They've already been doing that. Now if China bans some American company, these same lawmakers will cry foul and say, how dare they? China is being anti-competitive. And not just that, I mean, look at the recent stories that we've been talking about on Tesla. Like, Tesla is facing this huge wave of Chinese competition in China over even less expensive EVs. And the fact that Chinese manufacturing seems to be able to undercut the prices of a Tesla is now being viewed as an anti-competitive step. And you're like, this is always how this is played out in China. What was the other one? I didn't put it in our show notes, and I can't remember where I read it, but we also saw smartphone sales dip in China 7% year over year, looking at 2023 sales versus 2022. But we saw every other manufacturer's market share drop, but Huawei and Honor both surged. So China is definitely circling the wagons, and I think it's also becoming sort of a source of hometown pride, where people are showing off, in China, people are showing off the phones that they own came from their country. And we're trying to do the same thing with Apple here in the United States. And it's working, you know, like 50% of them, over 50% of the market share is now Apple. But I don't think we're going to see those numbers move around a whole lot. I don't think you can hold up Apple as being some paragon of virtue of American, idealism and blah, 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 blah. Whereas I feel like the commentary that China is able to now step into is like, look, it's the whole world against us. Are you supporting your country, your home, or are you buying from competitors that, are trying to take advantage of the Chinese market? It's going to get messier. It's going to get a lot dirtier before we sort of like calm everything down and then maybe get to some reasonable market corrections. Because I think a lot of these companies do deserve some stricter policy, some stricter oversight, and some market corrections in how they do business. But that's a far cry from TikTok is China and China is an adversary of the United States. So now we must do battle with this one app. To me is very aggressive language to be putting into a bill trying to regulate social media on the internet.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Oh yeah, Renish. And this is also something that's going to start bleeding over. Interestingly, Huawei for this year increased their European push. They are going to introduce a ton of new products, at least here in the Netherlands. Again, now that they've bolstered their sort of market share in China, the next step would be, can we start selling more broadly? And this is dangerous territory for a company like Google, because we had to carve out these distinct lines in the sand. And I think when people see, like, you know, you could have a really solid consumer-facing pocket computer experience without being intrinsically tied to a platform of services from Google or Apple, I think there are some consumers that are going to like that. I think there are some people that are really going to jump on board for that. I have taken great pains to not get too entrenched in any one platform of services. So I'm spread out all over the place. A little Microsoft here, a little Android there. I'm now trying to find more open source, like FOSS apps to replace things on my phone. I hate the Google Photos app for looking at pictures on my phone. I'm now on Fossify. You know, stuff like that starts to trickle. It starts to kind of bleed into the greater conversation. And if you've got a company like Huawei out there saying, like, nah, just cut the tie, just cut the cord, you're going to be fine. And then the phones are actually really nice, then yeah, that can work. That can generate some chatter with consumers. All right. This is just another quick follow-up. I'm not going to spend as much time on this one. It's a really ugly story, and I don't do a lot of trigger warnings, but this one I found really upsetting when we talked about it the first time, and this is just sort of the next step in how we are racing ahead on certain tools and then not considering the ramifications of how those tools are going to be used or abused. And so we talked about kids making abusive imagery of their classmates with AI products. This is a story out of Wired. Caroline Haskins on Wired. Florida middle schoolers arrested for allegedly creating deepfake nudes of classmates in what appears to be the first criminal case of its kind. Two teenage boys were charged under a 2022 Florida law for allegedly creating AI-generated images depicting middle school classmates. And this is a very ugly and nuanced legal battle that we're about to face, because it's not actually child abuse imagery, but it is featuring real live kids. And the AI tools were capable of generating these images in a way that then was spread around their school, probably caused abject humiliation to the kids that were the victims of this. And we're dealing with middle school teenagers, you know, fully formed brains that are completely capable of understanding the ramifications of their actions. But it's also kind of a commentary on, like, what are we doing with and with our boys in situations like this, that you go to such a hostile act, hostile degree of ruthlessly embarrassing a classmate. I feel like the language on this needs to be stronger so that we make this as unfashionable an idea as we possibly can, as aggressively as we can. Because it wasn't like, I'm not saying that this is okay. I'm just saying in the range of harm, of potential harm, this isn't like a group of middle school boys taking the face of a celebrity. We've been trying to battle like celebrity deepfakes for years. I mean, long before AI was touted as this thing, there have been celebrity deepfakes. It's gross, right? Taking classmates, part of the fun, big air quotes, because it's not fun, part of the fun is this caused a student pain, or would cause another classmate pain if they were to find out. The cruelty is a part of the creation of the media. And these kids thought that was fun. And I don't think the message is getting out there that this is vile, not just because it's child abuse imagery, but it's child abuse imagery of kids who really exist and will be harmed by the dissemination of this media. And that to me is just another step. We're so broken in how we talk about these tools, how we like help kids develop, how we integrate technology into the classrooms, how we bring kids into the 21st century economy. And this is to me like one of those perfectly encapsulated little bubbles of a situation that showcases just how far off the mark we really are. And it's pretty dark. It's getting really dark out there. And I don't know a way that we can encourage our lawmakers to take a nuanced look at what's going on in this market and try to reach out to big tech companies. We've got all these people who still act like I'm this little upstart and, you know, disrupt and break things. And, you know, that's where the future is going to be. And you're like, you know what? I actually think that this is evidence of us needing to take a course correction and figure out the problems before we just rush to disrupting and breaking things. That to me is a massive disconnect between the companies and the leaders of these companies, the executives of these companies trying to rush forward with this and not considering outcomes. We can kind of look at like little pieces of industries all over the place. I think there's a problem similar to this in the movie industry. It's, well, we're not really empowering storytellers. What we're going to do is shoot a whole bunch of stuff, and we know that there's like a formula for action films, and then we just fix it all in editing. But then you go and see a really well-crafted movie that does something different or, you know, subverts your expectations, but for real, not as the joke subverting your expectations. And then suddenly it's like a fluke. Well, there's no way that that movie really should have succeeded. It's different than the formula. Disruption in the like post internet bubble crash from 2 decades ago. Disruption was some exciting concept of forcing growth and opportunity. Right now, we need regulators and lawmakers and citizens in general to catch up and figure out, like, hey, this is what this thing really is. And as much as we've gotten shareholders super excited about hearing AI in every kind of pitch and presentation, that's probably a fad. And then we'll probably figure out that it's not as useful as we think it is. And then NVIDIA will probably shift courses and sell GPUs to some next fad. And then a year from now, we'll all be like, hey, remember like when language learning models were a big deal and how Gen AI couldn't figure out fingers? Yeah, that was weird. Anyway. Wrapping this one up, it's ugly and it's gross and it's dark, but I really do feel that like this is one that needs to be talked about much more broadly in much more decisive commentary. The language needs to be so much more direct and so much more focused on the cruelty of this particular act we need to make it very unfashionable for kids to do this kind of stuff in the future. And just really hammering home, like, you have to be borderline sociopathic to think something like this is fun. To think that harming other kids in your class like this is just for the lulz. There's something fundamentally broken about you if this is what you want to use this technology to do. I don't know how we get there. I really unfortunately think things get worse before they get better. Some people are complaining about buffering. I haven't seen any disruption to chat, and I haven't gotten any warnings. Like, I'm showing green bars on Restream. So, unfortunately, there could be something going on between Restream and Twitch, or Restream and YouTube. So, apologies there. I'm trying to go back through the chat here, and I'm also trying not to throw all my coffee burps directly into the mic, so apologies for that. Human biology is ridiculous. Through Jermaine's lens, whoever makes those tools, why on earth even make it possible to do something like that? And it's why we fundamentally don't understand what's going on with the current slate of AI tools, is because you start putting out sort of the frameworks. And some really industrious middle schooler can take bits and pieces from GitHub libraries and put together something that can do something like this. Again, it's like, I'm sure Microsoft Copilot wouldn't allow me to do something like this, but the bits and pieces that kind of work on other internet projects could be eventually assembled into something that could do this. It's why I feel like, on the one hand, it's also on us to do a better job of educating consumers on what AI really is. And on the other, it's we've got to stay on top of new tech trends so that we can properly inform the upcoming generation, like, hey, this is where we're going to run into some problems. Unfortunately, you know, like, I'm a crossover Gen X millennial. I tend to side more millennial in terms of policy and politics, but I'm right on the cusp. Born in 1980. Nobody wants me. Gen X doesn't claim me. Millennials think I'm too old. But we've got to be able to sort of translate moving forward. Now that I have a daughter, I'm going to be able to say, like, hey, this is a really cool thing. I love that you love, you know, talking to, you know, Google's assistant and getting, you know, like, wacky jokes and riddles. This is also terrible technology if you use it for this. And, like, I know I'm setting myself up for some rough years when she's in high school, but it's something that we need to be able to sort of better educate and work with younger kids on. Sorry, I'm like definitely catching up on the chat. There was a lot of chatter and some other stuff there too, but uncensored. Yeah, Simon says Hypno. Uncensored language learning models are freely available. It is not hard to track down the tool sets to use them for whatever you might want to use. Septian, that's very kind of you. We'll claim you, Juan. We need leaders. I don't know that I'm a good leader. I don't know if anyone's my age or close to my age. You remember Andy Rooney on 60 Minutes. Unfortunately, I feel like that's my place in the commentary. I will be the cranky old man yelling at VCs to get off my lawn. Michael Corcoran, a tweener. I still an article about people like us born between 1978 and 1982, Generation Catalano from My Sold Called Life. Oh no. You just said that and now I need to go and rewatch My So-Called Life. Oh, that show can't have aged as well as I think it did in my brain. Oh no, I've got to rewatch that show now. Okay, we've got a pair of Apple stories, one that I do want to spend a little time on and one that I'm kind of bringing up because it's an interesting read. This is hard shifting gear. Sorry, I don't have good transitions for the news block on this podcast. So, jumping in, This is coming from the Epic Game Store, the actual press release from Epic. Update: Apple reinstates Epic developer account after public backlash for retaliation. March 8 update: Apple has told us and committed to the European Commission that they will reinstate our developer account. This sends a strong message to developers that the European Commission will act swiftly to enforce the Digital Markets Act and hold gatekeepers accountable. We are moving forward as planned to launch the Epic Game Store and bring Fortnite back to iOS in Europe. Onward! So, we have kind of a piecemeal iOS strategy that's happening right now. The iPhone is becoming a different entity in the EU than it is here in the United States. We're seeing those tangible differences in things like interoperability and support for, you know, alternative app stores or sideloading or whatever kinds of conversations that we're having here. It's frustrating because, like, I'm no grand fan of Epic, but they were the ones big enough to bankroll some kind of legal challenge and keep up the chatter on this enough that we saw some tangible change. It took years, some tangible change in how regulators are handling Apple. Like I said earlier in this podcast, I think big tech companies are overdue some market corrections in how they are scrutinized and regulated. And this is one where I don't think Epic is some shining, virtuous upholder, defender of liberty. They were the ones who had a big enough bank account to go to war with Apple's legal team. So you march the army you've got, not the army you want. This one has been kind of interesting to see how fast that turnaround was, because Apple was fairly punitive in their assessment of whether or not they would reinstate Epic's developer account. And I think in years past, they probably would have gotten more boisterous support from their users. This time it didn't play out that way. When I'm watching sort of the chatter, you would see on Threads, or, you know, like occasionally still someone sends me a link to like a conversation on Reddit that's just spinning completely out of control. I have not seen the same unification of walled garden policy support for Apple devices like we've seen in years past. This one was specific, where someone would be like, yeah, but Epic showed bad faith and they already broke the terms of service for the App Store policy guidelines. And then someone would immediately counter with, yeah, they broke the terms of service to show anti-consumer trends and how Apple's apps don't have to play by the same rules. And it's just interesting to see, because like this is like an iOS-focused conversation. This is an Apple-focused conversation, and Apple did not have complete support. Apple users were the ones also complaining about Apple policy. And so this, to me, kind of helped inform, it is a big deal that Apple isn't fighting this aggressively as they might have in years past. If there'd been more overwhelming support for this policy and even Apple's users were out there saying, hey, this is a bridge too far, we don't want this, then I think Apple probably would have dug in their heels and made this a bigger court case and forced the European Commission to really go after them. Instead, they got kind of a half-hearted reaction to this. And that's not good when the identity of Apple as a market leader, the identity of Apple is so entrenched in the fashion of Apple products and the sort of aesthetic of Apple. They don't want to publicly come out, lose a regulatory fight, and then further inform their own users that, hey, maybe Apple hasn't been always so great for users and developers. So it was better for them to kind of walk it back, try and keep it quiet, but of course this is still getting a lot of attention and still getting a lot of chatter. Kapakosh, Apple is scared of their walled garden cracking. Their walled garden has to crack. I mean, again, it's not like it's going to fall. And again, it's so funny when other Apple users are the ones making these arguments in a lot of these conversations. I don't want apps to be full of malware and viruses. And immediately it's another Apple user saying, then don't sideload apps. Then don't use another app store. Again, it's like Apple's marketing has only informed like the pithy little tagline to a commercial. And people feel they're informed on tech, but they're just parroting, regurgitating what they've heard in an Apple commercial. Macs don't get viruses. I still hear people saying stuff like that from a commercial in the year 2024. So that to me is one of the most important aspects of how regulatory change has a profound impact on consumer education and how companies do business with their customers. Anytime we hear someone like, oh, but government, and it's too heavy, and it never works, and you don't want. But that's different. If we are doing a better job of crafting some of these regulatory reactions, then yes, we can have a positive impact on a customer's relationship with a business, and consumers have some recourse if they don't like how a company is choosing to do business with them. If we keep pretending that like a free market solution to this would have arisen, then we're doomed and our hobby is doomed. There needs to be some resource that can push back. We can't leave it up to the epics of the world deciding that they've had enough and that they'll burn millions and millions and millions of dollars to do court battle with companies like Apple. And then those court decisions set precedent, but only in very limited spheres. Like Epic doing battle with Apple doesn't change anything for other developers unless we start setting stronger legal precedent and regulators follow up on that with targeted regulations that help improve the landscape for competition. It can't just be free market and then court battles. Yeah, Vasikos. This is another part. I mean, like, we let Apple control the narrative, right? I'm not calling it spatial computing. That's stupid. It's mixed reality. Why are we letting Apple define how our brains think of words to describe technology that existed before Apple got involved? Sorry, Vasikos writes, I'm with Luis Rossman on this. Back in my day, sideloading was called installing. Yeah, you have a computer that you install programs on. Chances are pretty good if it's Windows, Linux, or Mac. You're not thinking, I'm subverting the Windows App Store to sideload a program in Windows 11. Microsoft really wants you to think that way, but Microsoft can't train your brain to think of installing a program on your computer as sideloading an app. It just can't. There's too much momentum and history. We know how a Windows machine works. An iPhone is a computer. I know they don't want it to be thought of, but that's exactly what it is. And if you want to be able to install a program on your pocket Apple computer, we need to stop letting Apple and Google tell us that this is somehow a subversion of how the thing should be used. The thing should be used in any way that you want to use it. And if you want to install programs from a shady website and possibly, you know, blow up your life or have all of your information compromised, more power to you. If you're like me and you want to like find alternative stores for specific focused applications, I like F-Droid. F-Droid is a silly little place full of open source software developers, and you can find some crazy great tools and resources. My favorite RSS reader, my favorite photo gallery, video downloaders, things that help you kind of manage your footprint on the internet, VPN application. Like, if you want to find tools that aren't just intrinsically tied to Google Play, F-Droid is a phenomenal resource for you to find developers crafting their own homegrown tools and applications. Great services on there. There's a funky little tower defense game. It's cheesy graphics. It is super, super basic, but it's actually a really well-crafted little tower defense game. I'm playing that right now on my phone. So it's stuff like that that, yeah, I want to see. I want to see the Epic Game Store come to Android with more than just Fortnite in there. I want to be able to install games that have support for little ARM chips. And then you could have a direct... I should be able to get games from Steam if I want. Or we used to have a Humble Bundle. You can still download this APK. It doesn't really work anymore. But Humble Bundle used to reach out to game developers and come up with little game packs. And you could buy directly from Humble Bundle, save money over getting it through Google Play. And then those apps were updated in Humble Bundle's own little APK store. Stuff like that, like, yeah, why wouldn't we want the ability to find an alternative? Or see that a game developer can do business with another entity to distribute their games. So it's that kind of stuff that that's the reality of sideloading. It's really frustrating that we've kind of let Apple and Google say that this is somehow I just kind of keep wanting to come back to the word subversion. It's a subversion of your relationship with the phone. It's not something that we ever intended you should be able to do. Well, then, yeah, that's a problem. It's a problem that you don't think I should be able to use the software on these products the way that I want to. So that's a bummer. From Junkie, wasn't the term mixed reality coined by Microsoft? Aren't we doing the exact same thing, not just with Apple? You know, that's fair, but the issue I have is we started with virtual reality, VR. So someone had to come up with this phrase. And honestly, we've been talking about head-mounted immersive video experiences for decades. The first head tracking device was in like the 1960s. So we start off with a very scientifically accurate but clumsy way to describe the functionality of what this thing is. And then at some point we start refining that. So we go from head mounted visual immersive capabilities to virtual reality. And this goes hand in hand with also like decades of science fiction. I put on a helmet and I can see a different place. And well, what do we call that? It's a reality, but it's virtual. It's a virtual reality. So yes, at some point someone has to make that word. So then, roughly around in the 80s, we're also talking about heads-up displays. So there is pass-through video, and then information is layered on top of that, and that's one of the huge things that was an advantage for our fighter pilots. Starting in the 80s, I remember as a kid living on military bases, like how exciting it was when we started seeing things like, it was in 88 or 89. There was this whole expose on the new helmet, how expensive the new helmet was for the Apache helicopter, and how early Apache helicopter pilots were having these huge problems with like migraines and the biology of it, because they would have different information systems going to each eye, and each eye was getting different information. I might have that wrong. It might not have been the Apache, but still, we started coining, there is a video pass-through system that layers information in a heads-up display on top of this, and that's how we get this information through. And then we started talking about sort of clear passive displays. You're still looking through a transparent screen, and then information is getting layered on that screen. We are augmenting your reality. So now we've got VR, virtual reality, and we have AR, augmented reality. Hold on, I got to take a drink of water here. I'm a little congested. Hold on one sec. So we've got the one end of the market, virtual reality, totally enclosed, completely immersive, There is no relationship to you between you and your surroundings. Then we've got the opposite. We've got augmented reality. It's a completely open system that just puts information up in your line of sight. And then we have a spectrum of experiences that kind of live in the middle. We have heads-up displays. We have video pass-through systems. And at some point, someone has got to take what's happening here and craft something in the middle. So what is mixed reality? Microsoft popularized that term. Absolutely. And they actually sold their line of headsets, calling them mixed reality headsets. But Microsoft took that step when we could do things like inside-out tracking. So with older virtual reality headsets, to get them to work, you had to put sensors up all over your room. The headsets themselves had very limited capabilities for understanding where they were in space. They only had the sensors that understood sort of the movement of the headset, and they had to be tracked externally. So mixed reality became synonymous with cameras in the headset, video pass-through so you could see sort of what was happening around you, and that you didn't have to install all of these sensors. Mixed reality, as coined by Microsoft, or as popularized by Microsoft, was a distinct step in between virtual reality and augmented reality. It did help us define and describe something different and was a positive forward movement. Apple has not changed any of that. Apple is now trying to say spatial computing is something different. But what is it? It's an inside-out, head-tracking, immersive video pass-through system. So we already had a phrase for that. The phrase was mixed reality. And then, on top of all of this, we use XR, extended reality, as the blanket term for anything that you put in front of your eyeballs that can kind of change how you see or interact with the world or immerse you in content. So Apple is choosing to step completely away from virtual reality, mixed reality, augmented reality, extended reality, and they're calling their solution spatial computing. Just like they call their ARM chip Apple Silicon, just like they call their file transfer protocol AirDrop. They're not coming up with anything new. They're just changing the terminology that we use to describe it so that they can put a brand label on it, so they can put like a registered trademark on it, and then we think in terms of how Apple wants to describe that technology. The Vision Pro is a mixed reality headset. That's what it is. It's not augmented reality. It's not like HoloLens. It's not virtual reality. It's not like a Valve Index, which needs sensors in your room. It is right smack dab in the middle with inside-out tracking, video pass-through. It's a mixed reality headset. That's what it is. But they don't want you to call it that because they want you to think it's somehow different or somehow special compared to every other MR headset we've ever sold. So that's why I get really persnickety about whenever Apple jumps into these conversations, because it's usually not for any new step or any new consumer benefit. It's usually Apple is late to the party, so they've got to make it sound like it's something different or special. But the only way they can do that is by ratcheting reporters and ratcheting developers. If you want early access to our products, you have to talk about them with these special phrases and with this like a special consideration for the product. And if you don't do that, then you don't get early access and your videos won't make as much money. Sorry, I'm way behind on the chat here. Colonel Corn Pop, it isn't water. This is water. No, so that was the joke in, was it Parks and Rec? They're trying to get all the citizens of Pawnee to drink more water, and they have to come up with an app that gives you like H2Go points, and then you can get swag. And you're like, yeah, unfortunately, that's what we need to do to kind of break the marketing grasp that these companies have on how we talk about sideloading and AR and VR. It's like, We've got to market something that sounds cooler so people get excited about it. Simon says it. No, exactly. Apple renamed it so they can say they created it. Apple created spatial computing. And what is spatial computing? It's their dev kit for mixed reality applications. That's all it is. There isn't anything in there that is unique to the experience of having an inside-out head spatial tracking system that pulls information in and can kind of process on device. That's an HTC XR Elite. That's an Oculus Quest. Like, we've had them. They exist. And Apple now joining this space hasn't done anything to make that better. The mixed reality side of it. The mixed reality side of it is the same. What Apple has done is they've made it so much more expensive so they could add better components. I mean, that's kind of cool. We do get higher resolution. Well, this is another one that I dropped. I might share the link just sort of on social media, but someone has taken the time to like do this hard-hitting investigation on the optics and the lenses in the Vision Pro versus the Quest. And like Apple is getting away with issues with like screen door effect and moiré by making the lens purposely ever so slightly blurrier. So even though the Vision Pro has this insane resolution advantage over the Quest, when you really look at fine detail, it's kind of the same. So you're spending all of this money on these 4K displays, and you're really not getting sharper visual quality when you look at similar images and similar content. And again, it's like there are so few people who would be willing to do that kind of an investigation and actually share the conclusion, because you won't make money that way. You don't make money saying, oh no, the Apple product is the same or actually is inferior in these ways. And there are so few people who own both a Vision Pro and a Quest and the tools to properly measure the optics and to properly record, you know, sort of the view that you get from these optics and then publish their results, who then would be totally fine losing early access to Apple product launches. And because think about it, like we spent 2 weeks just like occupied totally by Vision Pro content, and then all of that evaporated. So all of those Apple brand fans who were touting Vision Pro as being this new amazing step in spatial computing, they weren't earnest VR participants. They weren't earnest AR, interested in extended reality glasses and experiences. They were just Apple brand fans. They work at major publications. They know Apple brings in clicks and views. And then once they saw that that coverage was starting to wane and their Google Analytics were starting to drop, well, time to move on to something else. They were never going to stick around. Now we can see what developers are really going to do with this hardware. It's always that way. It is always completely rigged by what will search engines do for our traffic? Can we make more money on it? Not really properly educating their consumers. So, now, junkie, but that's not true. As far as I've seen, all the tier one influencers and media outlets have pointed out the nonsense of calling it spatial computing. No. Pointing out the nonsense of calling it spatial computing is not calling it spatial computing. It's calling it mixed reality. The nonsense is, oh, Apple says we have to call it Vision Pro, not the Vision Pro. Don't you think that's silly how Apple can manipulate our content? Anyway, Vision Pro is the best headset out there. That's not calling it out. That's capitulating. That is a distinct difference from calling it out, junkie. And let me tell you, boy howdy, do you not make money on tech content if you do actually push back against the insane requirements of playing ball with Apple. So, can confirm, don't make money on videos on social media, this guy. So, we do have one other little Apple story. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. Bloomberg has this really interesting look at the car that Apple spent billions of dollars working on and then never really released. And so, I mean, if you have a Bloomberg account, I would like folks to kind of just read through this because it's an interesting story. It's not necessarily like a super deep dive in all of the like technical ramifications of what Apple was doing in the car market and trying to make a self-driving EV. But it's these little sort of like on background interviews and sort of the history of how we got to this point, kind of from the early 2000s to now, where they've properly canceled this. And we're starting to get some information out on what Apple was working on. it's little trickles. It's not anything super distinct, or it doesn't really, shine hard light on what was accomplished. But it just kind of goes to show that there's sort of a tech hubris where a lot of these companies, I think they start believing their own marketing nonsense in what they can create and what they are capable of. And then when that starts to get tested, you know, there are a couple different paths that you can take. You can double down, you can, reach out and maybe collaborate. There were rumors here, Apple was investigating maybe an acquisition. Maybe they could buy Tesla or something like that. And we get to the end of this, and the numbers are definitely not concrete, but we're estimating around $10 billion was probably spent on developing technologies that hopefully would have resulted in a car that Apple could sell. And this isn't a, Apple fails again kind of story. This is, to me, is just interesting. Like, where do you go after the iPhone? The car is becoming an accessory to our phones. There's so many people, I think, are looking at the relationship they have with technology and information and the pocket computer that they use. And then they might make a purchasing decision on a car that complements the phone that they own. This is how we're kind of prioritizing the different pieces and parts in our personal area networks. So $10 billion is at once an incredible amount of money for a company to spend on R&D, and at the same time is such a small amount of money when we think about what it would take to properly join the automobile industry and release a product that consumers can buy. So it's this really dynamic push and pull, and it helps... It helps highlight how a company is not one thing. A company is an amorphous blob of different departments with different goals and different budgets that they all answer to, like an executive branch and an executive team. But it's why I feel like we need to be doing a better job of compartmentalizing. When this division in this massive corporation is doing something exciting, let's really follow it. Let's really get excited about it. But then we still, it's our responsibility to really hammer and criticize a different division within this amorphous corporate blob when they do something we don't like. To me, the perfect example is I do actually really like what the Google hardware, the Pixel team, the accessory team, I think they're doing some of the best work this company's ever been able to produce. At the same time, I'm viscerally disappointed in Google Search and YouTube as entities under the same corporate umbrella. For Apple, I am critically interested in anything their silicon division does, because I think the M series ARM chips, and even I'm not as excited about A series these days, but even their A series, we still see these kind of generational updates and improvements. And every now and then there's a feature I see on an A series chip I really wish I had on a Qualcomm or a MediaTek. That kind of battle is what keeps competition healthy and gets us really excited about what comes forward. I am viscerally disappointed in Apple's executive team and their services department and their marketing department. I think that is helping tear apart the fabric of modern day society. So again, if we want Apple to change, it has grown beyond just, a couple people are voting with their wallet. No, these are entrenched business positions that, benefit from rigged economies and anti-consumer business practices and anti-competitive business tactics. The car story is really interesting because it steps on so many individual little pieces and parts of Apple. What they're doing with their chips versus what they're doing with their software and services, how they're building these autonomous systems. Apple's AI play is very lukewarm. They've made all this, they didn't even do like a big press event. They released new MacBooks and they said, now we're the leader in AI. Only because in about another month, they're about to get their clocks cleaned by Qualcomm. Because Qualcomm's investment in AI, NPUs, neural cores is on another level compared to Apple. Even MediaTek. I have a sit down. Okay. I have that interview with two media tech executives. Finbar is always just a fun conversation. But in the middle of that conversation, one of the questions I got from folks on Patreon was, well, what do you think about what Apple's doing here? And what do you think about this? And, you know, of course, they're very deferential. Apple, we can't ignore, they're a market leader and they do some really exciting stuff. But then immediately hammered home, like, yeah, they're not doing anything with AI. And even if they were, they're not empowering their chip to do this. And then also, like, you know, the base model RAM is always going to be a problem if you're trying to unpack, you know, language learning libraries, the number of parameters that they can unpack. This is a part of our conversation. We're going to be talking about the Pixel 8. It's just like, sure, yeah, they're real big and they're cool, but they're not doing anything. And so now the MacBook having these, letting the neural cores on the MacBook be opened up and hopefully courting more developers, it's kind of like Vision Pro. They don't have anything to do with AI. They don't have an AI-forward business model. They have hardware that other developers can use to maybe make another generation of really cool AI applications. But what we're going to see is basically just people taking the same models and the same components and systems that we already have and then just getting them to run on Apple's hardware. That doesn't improve the state of on-device AI. It only catches Apple up to what we've kind of already been doing on Android phones for a couple of years now in like really basic ways. But also, like, what I can do on a OnePlus 12 now on the device, not using any kind of cloud-based AI, is ahead of what you can do on a MacBook.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hey, what's going on, Juan, and all of you tuned in to today's show. I'm Nick Gray from Fandroid. I've known Juan for quite a few years now, and you may have actually heard my voice from back in the day when Juan used to host the Pocket Now Weekly. If you're not familiar with Fandroid, we were actually the very first Android news site to hit the web, publishing our very first article within hours of Google making their announcement about their mobile operating system. Of course, a lot has changed since then, but we're still here covering the news, reviewing new gadgets, and of course, sharing our passion for Android with anyone who wants to join in. You can find all of our work on Fandroid.com. That's Phandroid.com. But if you love video, and I'm sure you do since you're listening to Juan's podcast, be sure to check us out at youtube.com/Fandroid as well. And that's going to do it. Juan, thanks for featuring us. Back to you.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I can't pronounce Skrzekzakkwikkazols. I am so sorry. I can't pronounce your username at all. Apple knows that given technology doesn't exist before they reinvent it. Easy. That's how Apple's marketing has totally played. So definitely check this out, because I think the Apple Car finally being canceled is a really interesting look at how different power structures in different departments inside a megacorp can operate, and how, I mean, a lot of the technologies that they're working on here will probably find some solutions out in the market in general. They just won't sell a car. And I think we're all fine with Apple not selling a car. Another quickie that is just disappointing news. 2024 has already been marked by an insane number of layoffs and a lot of business divisions getting shut down. And I put both of these links in my show notes independently, not realizing when I put them in there that back to back, this is another double whammy from Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers has been on a tear, just killing divisions, killing content, removing things from catalogs. And at some point, I feel like this is another situation where we probably need to start talking about some kind of regulatory pushback. It apparently doesn't seem to bother investors enough that Warner Brothers' stock price has tanked over the last 2 years. They're not making money, and they keep killing projects and content. So the two stories, I have one from Ars Technica. This is written up by Kevin Purdy. Excuse me. Developers left with tough choices as Warner Brothers ends all Adult Swim games downloads. And we've got a couple of questions and a couple comments from developers that were distributing games on Adult Swim through Adult Swim, and how Warner Brothers has signed these contracts and they're killing the distribution, removing these games, and then not giving the developers the ability to kind of get their game back. One of the choice quotes is, Polygon received confirmation from the developer of the Rhythm Bullet Hell game Sound Dodger Plus that they received a delisting notice. Michael Molinari told Polygon that he, too, requested his game be transferred and, quote, explained clearly that it takes literally three clicks to transfer ownership to me, end quote, but a Warner Brothers representative rejected his request. So you're left kind of without any recourse. And, like, how do you get the game back when these media contracts and this ownership gets really complicated and the distribution rights also get really, really messy? So then, it was like a day later, or was it a day earlier? So that was March 6th, and the other one was... Okay, so this was a day earlier. Sorry, I reversed the order of these stories. Warner Brothers is also shuttering Rooster Teeth. So the Roost podcast is going to continue, and some of the other Rooster Teeth shows are being shopped, but that doesn't really mean a whole lot. So Warner Brothers is exploring options for Rooster Teeth's catalog of content and IP, such as Red vs. Blue, Ruby, and Genlock. So I'm not as sad about Rooster Teeth as I am about Adult Swim games. Adult Swim distributing indie developer games was actually, like, it was highlighted as this kind of, like, boon for, you know, like, here's a little place that you can go. It's sort of like the indie film market. Here's this little place you can go. You can get your game, hopefully, a little bit more attention, better distribution rights, maybe even better payouts, depending on how your game performs. Rooster Teeth was kind of embroiled in its own issues as, like, a content house and how it treated its employees. And it's still sad that I think the team was somewhere around 100 employees, and they're all going to be getting laid off. So that is, I think it's always a little upsetting when you hear about someone's livelihood. You know, the cord just getting pulled on that, the cable unplugged. But the actual Rooster Teeth brand, I think, had been a little tarnished. But it's crazy to me that in two days, Warner Brothers, on top of killing a bunch of other projects and a bunch of other content, found two other content delivery platforms and just nuked both of those too. So I think this brings up some of those big questions. Like, at some point, what do you do with, like, a video game? And I really feel, to me, this is kind of like empty housing. If you're a property developer, and you own tons and tons and tons of houses, but most of them are empty because you can't get the insanely high rent or the insanely high payment that you want for that house. After a point, I feel like the government should say, hey, people need houses. You're out of step with the market. The market is speaking, if we believe in the free market. So sell your house, or the taxes on your property are going to quintuple this year, and then they're going to quintuple next year. You want to sit on it, that's fine. You want to wait for an owner who's going to pay you what you think these things are worth? Great. But we're going to continuously raise, disastrously raise, the property taxes on this until you decide to move. I kind of feel something similar needs to happen with video games. I don't know exactly how the legislation would function, but to me, the loose idea is, if you abandon a video game, there needs to be some path that you bring it, or the rights expire, and it enters the public domain. So it's not you need to do all this work to make it an open source and licensing and all this other stuff. But if you're sitting on a game and you decide, hey, not only are we not going to develop for it anymore, but we're also going to let it kind of, we're going to remove it from any ability for people to purchase it, then people who have the game should be able to sort of freely disseminate it. And right now we're in this weird gray area where games through Adult Swim are probably still licensed, protected content under the Warner Brothers umbrella. And if someone tries to put it out there for free, could in, find some kind of legal ramification facing them. But I don't think that should be. If the company has refused to allow for any type of distribution or sales, then I think in the whole history of preserving, you know, good work, good games, stuff like that, it needs to just fall into the public domain. If they're not going to give it back to the developer, and they're not going to have any kind of way or recourse for people to buy it, then it shouldn't be illegal to share it. I don't know exactly how you make that work with modern day copyright laws, but there needs to be some step in that direction. I think the same thing should happen to phones. As soon as you say a phone is end of life, then you need to open that phone up. You need to deliver a key that unlocks the bootloader so someone else might decide, I would like to flash a different ROM on my phone. It should be illegal for that phone to be locked in a dead end-of-life state and then become e-waste because of the software support for that phone. We're so far behind. You know, all of this technology is advanced so quickly, we do not have the tools to look at all of this and find a path to making this stuff work. But again, just a pair, back-to-back, Warner Brothers, just absolutely ridiculous chain of events. And again, I do not understand. If you were a shareholder and you had an investment in Warner Brothers and you saw the stock tank over these last 2 years and you look at all their business practices and they're not putting out content, why would you still be invested in Warner Brothers? I don't think it's going to get better in the short term. And these people only care about like quarterlies, right? I need to see line go up every quarter. Except it's been going down for like four consecutive... No, wait. I think it's been on a decline for six consecutive fiscal quarters. But someone will have to correct me on that because I don't memorize Warner Brothers earnings calls. Hold on. Junkie. This is a silly question. Junkie, would you allow the government to take over your YouTube channel if you decided to abandon it? No. Because I have a relationship with YouTube as a distribution system, and my content lives in a YouTube server. So if YouTube decided to abandon distributing content, then I should be able to freely disseminate my content. But I don't have an exclusivity distribution relationship with YouTube. So if I decide to abandon my channel, I can leave all the content up and people can freely consume it. I can shut my channel down and put all of my content up on archive.org. That is how you have a direct relationship. I've made all this content and people can download those videos, right? You can download my videos off of YouTube. I would prefer that people try to help and support the channel in ways that they see fit, but I'm not putting up any barrier to people getting my content, and YouTube is not putting up a barrier to people getting my content. So if someone makes a video game and they have a distribution deal with Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers says, no one can buy your game ever again, then I feel there should be some path to making that public domain or returning it to the person who developed the game. I don't see that that's controversial. So if the government entity that you're talking about in this instance should be a regulator, something akin to the Copyright Office, like we have regulators that handle IP disputes, and they should be involved in a conversation speaking directly with Warner Brothers to say, hey, you're abandoning and preventing anyone from acquiring this game. We're not going to enforce your IP. If you make a product and it becomes synonymous with that tier, you kind of lose the ability to protect your trademark, like Xeroxing something or Kleenex as a tissue. We already have paths in how we manage and protect intellectual property and trademarks where a trademark can kind of fall out of protected status. So what we need to do is then say, if a company is actively trying to prevent people from getting this content but still wants to protect their trademark, that's a direct conflict for what would be in the best interests of consumers. And that is wholly different than distributing videos over the internet. Yeah. Flying Squirrel, this is the biggie. Once you become a monopoly, free market rules no longer apply. Government power needs to confront monopoly power. And this isn't necessarily monopoly, because Warner Brothers is definitely not anywhere near powerful enough to be a monopoly. But it's a problem with anti-consumer business practices. This harms developers. This harms consumers. It's not a good precedent to set for how companies can make it look like they're cutting costs, but they're really not delivering the content that makes them more revenue and makes them more profits that would improve the situation for shareholders. And that's why I keep taking it back to shareholders. It is shocking to me that anyone would still be holding on to Warner Brothers stock. I am not qualified to make any kind of investment advice. Do not listen to me and then look at your portfolio and say, I've got to make some tough choices here. I don't get it. It is not based on the actual performance of the company. It's all based on what a CEO can create in terms of a narrative that makes people feel good about the performance of a company. It is all illusion. It is all storytelling. It's all emotion. And that's what seems to make stocks go up and down. But when you look at year over year over year, the incredibly poor performance of Warner Brothers stock, and that they're still cutting more content than increasing revenue or you can't cut costs out of a problem like this. At some point, you also need to say, this is how we're planning on making more money. Not saving money and reducing costs. They are destroying the brand. And long term, all of their streaming service subscriber numbers are dropping. Their engagement is dropping. They're not making money at the box office. I mean, at some point you need to turn the ship around and start investing in content that will get people to give your company more money. And they don't have the services. They don't have it. So I don't get why anyone would still be sitting on this, because I feel every day you sit on Warner Brothers stock is another day that it's going to be worth less than the day before. There's not going to be some sudden skyrocket in Warner Brothers unless they find some hook and they make something and it sells like hotcakes and everybody's just super, super excited about it. But I don't see that happening. I think this is the death of this company, and the CEO that they have is still going to be making, I think he makes like $200 million a year. So he's fine. It doesn't matter what he does to destroy this company. He's still got every golden parachute. Oh man, Michael Corcoran coming in with a conversation about Chomsky. We've got a few more Vasicose, but one, Batman. So I just like to highlight in my chat right now, I've got two really, an interesting, a longer comment from Michael Corcoran talking about Chomsky and regulating centers of private capital and yes, spot on. Immediately after those, we've got Vasicose, but one, Batman. Batman makes all the money. I just love that. I love the dichotomy. It's like what breaks my brain when I'm trying to catch up on the comments. And Goat V8, two words, Batman Beyond movie. That's going to make billions of dollars. Get it done. All right, in terms of, I had those two stories, things getting shut down, dire, really dark, kind of scary. An ugly side of the current tech and entertainment and media landscape. Just a quick little shining light. If you'd asked me 5 years ago if Nikon would have been in a good enough position to start acquiring other businesses, I would have laughed. But Nikon has had a huge turnaround over the last couple of years, and now they are acquiring RED. RED, the boutique manufacturer of cinematic cameras, the darling of the digital transition. It was like RED and Ari were doing battle years ago, and Peter Jackson shot that demo on a RED camera, and it just blew our minds how good that image looked for being digital. Digital is still a dirty word in a lot of film creator conversations, but Nikon had been on this downturn for a while, and there was not a lot of confidence in that company, especially when Canon was coming out with a cinema camera division, and we saw Panasonic stepping up and doing some interesting things with their cameras for video, and just a couple years ago, especially as they started looking at a serious distribution of mirrorless cameras, Nikon is now starting to come out, is now starting to produce some of the most interesting and exciting mirrorless cameras on the market today. Some really incredible stuff. And doing so well, apparently, that they can now buy RED. So now Nikon has a cinema camera division, and I am insanely excited to see what RED under Nikon is going to be capable of doing. Because I feel Nikon will take a more traditional approach to what gets cinematographers interested in cameras and optics. And they have an incredible history with cameras and optics. And they can bring that to the RED platform. And maybe also kind of hopefully get RED to focus just a little bit more. I used to be super... I used to be sort of like super deep in the weeds on every little sensor that would come out and the new bodies that were coming out and the like how you would put together a RED camera system, like the rails and the packs and the batteries and what audio solutions, and you'd build your own RED camera. I'm kind of hoping that Nikon can come in and say, hey, what if we made something like an Arri Alexa, blending all of that we know about Nikon and Nikkor glass, and combine that with the cinema sensors and the packaging and the products that you sell with RED. And what if we merged those and we did something that could go toe-to-toe with, like, the Arri Alexas out there? To me, it's like... camera news is not huge. I mean, we're talking about an industry where in mirrorless cameras... In standalone digital photography in general, maybe 15 million cameras... might be sold over 2024. This is not like the same kind of news when Samsung is talking about 300 million smartphones being sold, but this is such an interesting turn for the future of digital photography for cinematic use. Bionic Scoop saying, you know, the Nikon Z8 and Z9 are frighteningly good. Vasicose, Nikon made RF mount cameras, alternate universe alert. from Vasicose, maybe it's just the RED RAW video patent acquisition. Well, I mean, that's definitely a part of it, but I would expect Nikon to not just be sitting on, like, the RED RAW video doesn't make them enough money to be worth acquiring the whole company. But in the medium term, Nikon selling RED cameras and influencing the trajectory of RED cameras is really exciting. And so then in the longer term, maybe the RED label just becomes like an add-on to a Nikon camera. But they will definitely get all of the system experience that RED has built up over the last couple of years, because that's something that Nikon doesn't have, is a distinct cinema division in that same way. But then you start to kind of influence where RED's hardware trajectory could go, and I think Nikon has a better idea on where camera systems and camera bodies could head over the next couple of years. So yeah, absolutely a stunning move. Barry Johnson, Nikon, in my opinion, has the best out-of-the-box color science. Great move for Nikon. T-Bubs, the funny thing with RED is they use Canon mount and now are used by Nikon. But it's also kind of funny still, you know, I'll be curious to see how Canon handles their lens mount transition. Maybe there are some other cinema lenses, or maybe we'll see a Nikon with like an L mount. I'm just messing around. So John Gao, I wonder how Nikon will enforce the RAW video compression IPs. I don't think they're going to change much. I think it's still going to be RED is a division of Nikon, and now they'll have the backing of Nikon in enforcing their IP. And eventually I think RED gets folded, but that I think takes years. I think it takes years to properly assess where RED's division could go, how they can interoperate with Nikon's strategy with sensors and lenses. And then eventually on the other side of that, you know, the RED label is just a little label on a Nikon camera. But I think in the short term especially, nothing changes with how Red's relationship with their own customers and video editing, that's going to be exactly the same for a while yet. Oh, yeah, and Bionic Scoop, Z8 and Z9 are pretty capable video shooters. This can only help. And I think this puts a lot of pressure on companies like Panasonic. I made that L-mount joke. But again, the L-mount alliance has now got to look at a Nikon Red acquisition as being one of the most pressure-packed competitive moves that could happen against... Like, I keep talking, like, I want to upgrade my Lumix cameras and switch over to full frame, and I'm seriously still shopping the exit path for Micro Four Thirds to get an S5 2X. But I am eyeballing a Nikon. If I have to switch mounts, and now Nikon owns a cinema camera division, there's no guarantee I stick with Panasonic. I could look at Sony. I could look at Nikon. It's all over the place right now. It's wide open. Wide open. It's up in the air. So let me get this out of the way here. So we're kind of getting. Oh, I do want to talk about this one. This one really quick too. It's a study. I'm linking to sort of just the title page of the study, and this came from Search Engine Land. I don't know. This website. I don't think I've ever quoted this website before, but at the beginning of the podcast, I was talking about how it's getting kind of dire out there for content creators. There is no link between social media engagement and content readership, study finds. New research suggests that publishers may not derive the same benefits from using social media as they did previously. The study in 2022, Memo conducted research comparing social engagement and article readership. Given the dynamic changes in the social landscape, Memo decided to revisit the study in 2024. The company analyzed 26,000 news articles published between January 20 and February 20, covering over a wide range of topics and industries. The results. Memo investigated the correlation coefficient between social engagement, total reactions, comments, and shares, and readership, unique visitors to news articles. To provide context, a perfect positive correlation is represented by 1, while 0 indicates no correlation. Across the various industries, Memo found that the correlation mostly ranged around or below 0.1, as explained by Memo. So all of this effort and energy that we put into social media only makes social media platforms more money. You can work your ass off and get all of your numbers up on Twitter or Threads or Facebook, and it means nothing for your actual content and getting people to engage with your content. If the spectrum is from 0 to 1, then you getting an incredible amount of social media views is going to be a 0.1 or a tenth, under a tenth of that potential spectrum for engagement on your actual content, where you might be able to direct readers or customers or anything like that. So now that means you need to engage 10 times harder to get some of those numbers to fill in, which is all just money for the social media platforms, seeing all the engagement, seeing all the clicks, seeing all the views, all of the conversation. I mean, think about how often do you engage in the comments on an article versus talking about that article in a vacuum of social media engagement. So it's why, cranky people like me keep pointing out our relationship with these big, big information tech platforms is toxic and ultimately harmful to the relationship between the content creator and that creator's audience. So here's yet another study that's showing, boy howdy, do you not get benefits out of trying to engage on these social platforms. And the social platforms know that they can keep you away from your audience. So you better play ball or we'll make it way worse for you if you try to push back. So, we do have a couple of tech block, gadget block stories here, and this is kind of where we're going to wrap up what we're talking about this week on the podcast. Let me take another drink of water. First up, I'm just super sad. I mean, like, I put out a video, a follow-up on Windows on ARM a week before Microsoft decided to kill the Windows subsystem for Android, Windows Central actually did reach out, and they found a former, sorry, let me find exactly who this is. This is Andrew Klinik. He worked at the Microsoft. He worked at Microsoft as partner group project manager of Windows AI plugins, and he had to say store revenue pays the bills and salaries for the Windows subsystem Android team. Windows subsystem for Linux accrues to Azure, so has a profit center. Windows subsystem Android without a store is awesome, but doesn't help Windows financially. Honestly, when Google walked away, the nails were in the coffin. And this to me is the tragic, is the tragic, consistent failure of marketing. I posted like, hey, by the way, you won't be able to use Android apps in Windows 11 anymore. And I immediately got comments from people saying like, I didn't know that was a thing. And you're like, yeah, it was kind of a big deal when Windows 11 came out. It was a hot minute. A bunch of techies were like, oh yeah, you can do this. And then none of them ever talked about it ever again, except for nerds like me who would say, yeah, if you own this like Microsoft Surface, you have a Windows machine, a Linux machine, and an Android machine all in one. And a bunch of like laptop, gaming laptop tryhards would be like, oh, but nobody cares about that. No one is going to do things until like it gets taken away. And then a few people realize all this time, I could have had a Windows, Linux, Android tablet all in one. Instead of owning like a Windows laptop and an Android tablet, I could have just had the whole thing all in this slate. Don't we think that would have been a consumer benefit that you could have put into an advertisement? But neither Amazon, the Amazon App Store is just kind of a dumpster fire anyway, but Amazon is trying to get away from the image that they're just a cheap knockoff Android Fire company, whatever. And Microsoft, neither of them put that forward. Microsoft could have, through the Windows Store, started courting Android app developers. Why go through the Amazon App Store? Why not just have your mobile app ready to go for Windows? Think about when Threads launched. You know what one of the best experiences for Threads was at launch? It was sideloading the Threads APK on a Windows machine. That was actually one of the best ways for me to use and engage with Threads because they didn't launch with a browser support. And I didn't want to have to keep turning to a phone while I was working on a Windows machine. So I had my browser with all of my social media tabs, and then I had a little side panel with Threads in its own app, just running in Windows. That worked really well. And that kind of keeps going hand in hand and hand in hand. A good program for mobile can be a good program on Windows, but they didn't tie it to a way that they could have made money on it. So they could have undercut. They could have said, hey, you know what, Google Play? Google is charging you this, this, and this, and this to distribute your app. We're slightly better. So distribute your app for Windows, and you don't have to worry about doing anything. Bring the APK over to the Windows Store, and we'll distribute it that way. And people, when they install it, it'll go directly through the subsystem. We don't have to worry about sideloading, not installing your app. And then from there, everything would be great. But Microsoft couldn't be bothered to tell people about an incredibly useful feature or do any of the legwork to help try and build up a market for what that would be. It wasn't immediately profitable, so now we're going to lose it. And that drives me crazy. Well, Pakistan, I mean, I think we take for granted like how many apps that really matters to, though. So Pakistan says that's partially because the only good reason to use Android apps on a desktop was for the messengers that don't have web versions, and most of those can't operate with multiple devices. So how do we improve that situation? Do we keep doing the exact same thing we've always done, or do we start popularizing other potential methods for consumers to interact with products and services? And like my Threads example, that was one of the best ways to do it. And I showed people, and I got zero traction in people looking at that or talking about it. Because again, I can't signal boost something on social media and get people to engage with it. That's not a thing anymore. There are so many little applets and services. I mean, again, I brought up F-Droid. F-Droid is another good example. If someone wants to code a little hobbyist app and it turns into a useful service or a useful tool, how do you get them to bring it to Windows? You probably don't. Like, I have the Fossify photo gallery app on my Robo Incala. I like that better than Microsoft Photos. It's better. It's a better little way to kind of interact with photos on a tablet-y device. So there are so many of these little pockets and holes that Microsoft has. Like, how many of you, leave a one in the chat if in the last year you have spent money on software through the Microsoft Windows Store. I'm going to go to the chat and leave a number. And my number is reflective of how much money I have spent buying software through the Microsoft Windows Store. But for games, and the Windows subsystem for Android was a much better emulator than Google Play's version. So you could have brought other games to Windows and folded them into the Microsoft Store. And we can all sort of cluck and pat ourselves on the back that I get my games from Steam because I only play AAA games or Fortnite. And you're like, cool. But you know what? There are a ton of really fun Android games that we could bring to Windows and give developers an opportunity to make money on. And they would have had to blah, blah, blah. And they would have had to do zero work in bringing the APK over to the Windows subsystem for Android. And if you had a reasonably decently powerful older laptop, you probably had a more powerful Android device using the Windows subsystem than if you had purchased a standalone Android tablet. So, let's see. Anyone? Yep, okay, Simon says Hypno is a zero, Cedric is a zero, Aditya Anil is a zero, Hassam has a birthday cake? Is it your birthday, Hassam? I don't spend money on the Microsoft Store. Murder, I think I once bought the Dolby Atmos app for headphones in the last year. Aditya Anil, I have spent more money on the Android Store. Again, it sucks that Google wasn't going to back it, but Google's never going to back anything that Microsoft does. We know this from Windows Phone. John Gao saying zero. I don't know anyone who really shops for software on the Microsoft Store. I really don't. You do not have the same kind of idea or mentality that I fire up a Windows machine. Oh, I get it, Hassam. Sorry, the little emoji on my chat is too little. It looked like candles. Hassam is saying, big fat donut. That makes more sense. I was assuming, Hass, that you had not purchased any software. Donut related or otherwise. Sorry, it just caught me by surprise. So that's, to me, one of the critical failures. I point to this because of like my history in working in Hollywood. There are like talent agencies that are really good at developing an actor's career, and then there are talent agencies that want nothing to do with that. You come to us and you make us money and we'll represent you. And that's the feeling you get from Microsoft and Google right now. They are not interested in laying the groundwork and doing the consistent work to build up a new product. And then they're surprised when no one wants to use their new products. And you're like, that's the problem. You don't stick around. You sold Windows 11 to nerds like me on this interoperability. And I'm still stoked. I've got a Robo Incala that can use all these great Linux apps. But my ability to run a handful of Android services that I really liked on my tablet is now going away. You have removed functionality that you sold me on. And that makes me crazy. That makes me so angry that you could have developed this technology, sold it to developers, gotten people interested in doing business in a different way. Imagine. So you've got LumaFusion on Android, and they probably have some kind of loose developer relationship or agreement with Samsung. I think one of the primary reasons LumaFusion eventually made its way to Android devices was because Samsung helped pay for the development of that translation, of bringing it over. So they probably can't just go to Amazon or go to Windows or something like that. But just, I mean, like, free of that. I would pay for LumaFusion again to be able to run it on a little Windows tablet. It is that good. And it's so appropriately priced. I've purchased it for iOS devices. I've purchased it for Android devices. I would buy it again through the Amazon App Store to run it on Windows, or directly through Microsoft using that Windows subsystem for Android. It is fantastic. It is one of the best quick cut, splice, transition, add watermarks. Like, you really can't find a better video editing app for bridging more higher production level value and more consumer accessible tool sets. But now we don't have that path. If LumaFusion is getting just wrecked by DaVinci Resolve, what can LumaFusion do to bring that app to a Windows system? There is no subsystem, so they can't just port the APK with their sort of purchasing confirmation over to Microsoft. They would have to make a native Microsoft app. No one's making native Microsoft apps that are any good. You just forget about that. It's so frustrating to see yet another really cool perk vanish because Microsoft didn't consider how they would make money on it. And there were ways they could have started making more money on this stuff.
The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, meaudio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show.
Oh, yeah, Cedric Owens. I think a lot of us are right there. Crazy that I actually get frustrated when apps directly send me to the Microsoft Store. They definitely need to change the mentality to people. I go out of my way to not get the Windows Store versions of programs if I can help it. Yeah, Microsoft needs a win, and they just threw away a huge opportunity with apps that people are already familiar with that run better. And think about it. Like, when the Galaxy Tab S8 was out, Tab S8 was the first to get Android 13 on tablets. Windows 11 was the second to get Android 13 out for tablet-like devices. That's how crazy this, how crazy good this was in terms of support, in terms of updates, in terms of compatibility. It was so good. And now it's gone. Yeah, Nick, I don't even use the Microsoft Store for Microsoft software. I think the only time I really click in, I mean, I go into the Microsoft Store to update. It's so frustrating. You go to Windows Update to update Windows, and then you go to the Store to update all the little apps in Windows. But I think the one of the only times I've, in the last couple of years, I've even gone to the Microsoft Store was during the transition to Microsoft 365, where they were rebranding Office. When you got a new Windows machine, it was the web versions of Office. Like if you clicked on Word, it didn't take you to the Word program. It took you to Edge, which opened up Word in like an Office 365 cloud environment. And you had to go into the store to get the local program versions of Office 365. And then they changed that again. So now you can just go and download it like you always could. But for a second, it was like this convoluted, like, wait a minute, no, I don't want to work on this in a browser. Where do I get, oh, I've got to go to the Office, to the Microsoft Store. Okay, I'll install it from there. And now I don't even do that because they've gone back to just like, you can get the download from like Microsoft365.com or wherever it is now. So, so, so dumb. So the last story, what we're going to wrap up. I did want to point this out though. Okay. So Windows Central, they actually did some investigating. It's not like a heavy hitting, you know, investigative journalism piece, but you know, I have to highlight, sorry. This was Sean Endicott at Windows Central. There's a title. Here's why Windows subsystem for Android got killed off, according to a 29-year Microsoft veteran. Okay? That's a great title. And I know what's going to be in this article. They describe what's happened. They verify who this person is. They quote them and link the tweets that they shared. And they also did a little follow-up with some of the other developers and Microsoft's relationship with this product, the service. Now, here's why Windows subsystem for Android got killed off is the title at Windows Central. And over on Tom's Guide, we have a similar article. Windows 11 will stop supporting Android apps in 2025. Here's why. Now, don't you feel like those two articles have pretty similar titles? And the article from Windows Central has an answer which is informed by the experiences of someone who used to work at Microsoft. So I'm really curious. I wonder what Tom's Guide has to say about ending Windows app support. So we go through the article. This is the second to last paragraph of Tom's Guide. There we go. So the second to last paragraph over at Tom's Guide. Now that selling point is going away, and it's unclear why. Although Microsoft and Google have had their fair share of issues over mobile ecosystems over the years, the companies seem to have found common ground in Windows 11. So, the title of this article is, Here's Why, and in the article, it's unclear why. Why is it going away now? We don't know, but here's why it's going away. It's going away because we don't know why it's going away. So I just wanted to kind of point that out. I'm mad that I gave Tom's Guide a click. So I will not be linking to Tom's Guide, the coverage on this article, in the show notes on somegadgetguide.com, where you can go directly to a website to read and watch videos and support a content creator instead of just, you know, looking at stuff on social media. The link attributed to that story will be the Windows Central link. It's hilarious. Aditya Anil, FFS Tom, guide better. This is Tom's not much guidance guide. Simon says, if though, that's a cliffhanger article. Ooh, I wonder what's going to happen. Oh, we don't know. Wrapping up our conversation, because we are not getting close to 3 hours, but we are going over 2 hours. I wanna just kind of chat out. I think we all have some frustrations over the current executive business strategies from companies like Apple and Microsoft and Amazon, and especially Google. If you're a fan of using Android devices, like I would call myself a fan of Android, it is still incredibly galling to see confusing policies and inconsistent approaches to new products and services. So one of the gentlemen that I think is doing a really good job of staying like on the pulse, in the weeds, looking at the software that goes into our products is Michal. I am going to be linking and sharing to his Mastodon account, where he is sharing a lot of really interesting stuff on all the Android news. But he was one of the first people I saw talking about the Pixel 8 and Gemini Nano. So this is directly from Michal. Gemini Nano won't be coming to the Pixel 8 because of, quote, some hardware limitations, end quote, but will be coming to more high-end devices in the near future, according to Terence Zhang, a developer relations engineer at Google, during the Android show, talking about this situation. Also, Michal followed this up. The Pixel 8 and Pixel 8 Pro have the same chipset, Tensor G3, but different amounts of memory, 8 gigabytes versus 12. However, Gemini Nano is available on the Galaxy S24 series, which starts with 8 gigabytes of RAM. There may be some other hardware differences between the Pixel 8 and 8 Pro that we don't know of that are holding back Gemini Nano support. So, of course, this has resulted in a firestorm of Google has killed the Pixel 8. Google, you can't trust Google to keep up with their commitments to supporting the product. Look, they promised 7 years of software updates, and they've already killed the Pixel 8. The Pixel 8 is already obsolete because it's not getting this AI tool. And if you're a techie out there and you're sharing those types of sentiments, then you really don't understand the AI landscape as much as you think you understand how smartphones function. So it's like, at once, I'm very disappointed that Google has made this a dividing strategy between the Pixel 8 and the Pixel 8 Pro. I've been very frustrated that Google is selling two phones that are often kind of lumped together as being products of the same family, but really they should be better separated, like Apple does with the iPhone 15 and the 15 Pro. So it's kind of like Google is selling an iPhone 15 and an iPhone 15 Pro Max. Yes, they have the same Tensor G3, but there are so many more little feature differences that go between those two phones. So it's not the chipset difference, like an iPhone 15 to an iPhone 15 Pro Max, but there are other differences between a Pixel 8 and a Pixel 8 Pro. And I think Google has done a tremendously poor job of kind of helping walk consumers through what these different tiers should look like. And then you get things like the A series is so close now to what you get from the first number series, that the bigger jump is going from Pixel A to Pixel Pro, not Pixel 8 to Pixel 8 Pro. So all of this gets really, really, really messy. And it is frustrating. I think we all should be critical of how Google positions and presents products, because they've developed an incredible reputation for not following through on how they support their products, how they support their services. And I think the AI side of this strategy is equally confusing and frustrating, where we have Assistant, and we've had Bard, and now there's Gemini, but there's a Gemini Pro and a Gemini Pro for Business, but then also a regular Gemini, and now there's this new Gemini Nano. And Google has tried to blur the lines between what AI is really done on your device and what AI is done up in the cloud. And I think their strategies have been really clumsy. where I've been very disappointed in stylized photos and Video Boost, those services shouldn't need to be cloud-based. But it seems like an executive decision to say, process this video up in the cloud, so people will have to upload 4K video up to the cloud, and then it'll take up more storage on their Google Drive. And once you get them taking up more storage, well, they'll need to buy more cloud storage. And when I talk about really not wanting to be entrenched in any one company's products, Google Drive is one of those that I nod my arm off to get out of paying for Google One. I don't want to be beholden to Google strategies for cloud storage. And especially, it's why I've invested in putting more storage into my NAS, right? Like, that to me is like a better way to do business with a brand and a company. It's a better way to protect and to save, store, and share my data. And I'm now not stuck with these kinds of solutions. Like, if I want to do something with Video Boost, which is very rare, I can upload that one individual video and have that video boosted, pull it back down, and then delete it from my G Drive so it's not taking up space I don't need it to. I'm not sitting here trying to back up everything that I shoot, because I shoot an incredible amount of photos and videos from all of my mobile devices. To the same token, that's why I got so pissy and why I got so angry with Apple when they were going to do on-device content scanning. I don't believe for a second that that was to protect the children. I think it was they didn't want to pay for the servers to scan the content going up to their servers. And once you send up to the cloud, you really don't have expectations on privacy and security, because they can't be responsible for distribution of abusive materials. So as soon as you send something up to the cloud, you know it's probably getting scanned. But Apple didn't want to pay for the server load to scan all of the iCloud stuff. They wanted the phone that's in your pocket to do all the scanning for them, and it would have reduced their cloud storage bills, their cloud storage fees. So they were willing to build back doors into iPhones and compromise the security of iPhones just so they could save money on their cloud services. But I digress. So we get to Gemini Nano, and I don't think for a second that it really changes the relationship that Pixel customers have built with Google for that tier of phone. Because Google has done a terrible job of expressing what the differences in the tiers are, what expectations a customer should have with the AI capabilities of their phone. And the Pixel 8 isn't really a dramatic departure in terms of on-device AI. We really have to believe that over the next several years, that conversational relationships with our phones are going to take off to such a degree that the limitations of Gemini Nano, as we see them today, are going to influence someone's future spending. I think we're a ways away from that. I disagree, but I understand with why Samsung has also started phones off yet again with 8 gigabytes of RAM. To the flip side, I think there is a significantly different strategy from Chinese manufacturers, the Oppos and the Xiaomis, where they cannot count on cloud-based solutions. So what do we see from them? We see a much more aggressive RAM strategy, where a OnePlus 12 can be sold in China with up to 24 gigabytes of RAM, because it is more likely, in their opinion, they will be future-proofing on-device language learning model and AI capabilities years later. So this gets a little confusing. We talk about the NPU capabilities of like a Snapdragon 8 Gen 3 versus a Tensor G3. I believe that what we're seeing is the ramification of how that chip can process information, clear it, interact with the parameters of a generative AI plugin or a generative AI tool, and work through that limited amount of RAM. And I don't believe that the G3 is as capable. So an 8 gigabytes of RAM limitation on a Galaxy S24 in how we use Gemini Nano today is probably going to be okay. it probably won't perform as well as a phone with 12 or 16 gigs of RAM, but the performance compromises are low enough, they don't feel consumers are going to be overly upset by that experience on an S24. And Samsung can make that decision, they can put out that support or that capability, and I feel like Google has probably walked the other side of the saying, what Tensor is capable of and the MPU is capable of and how it works with swap space, we don't feel as confident that the Pixel 8 experience is going to be acceptable. And that's a bummer. But that to me is a different conversation than, well, Google has already failed in their commitment to support this for 7 years of software, because this isn't the same software conversation. This is an on-device AI tool. So the information is processed on the device, and if the device doesn't have the hardware to really utilize that AI, you don't want to try and run it from a device that's not capable of running it well. That's kind of like saying, oh, Google isn't going to support the Pixels for 7 years because you can't do face unlock. And you're like, well, yeah, but it doesn't have the camera and the capabilities and the focus and everything to do secure face unlock. It's just a software feature. You see how silly someone like that would sound if you were talking to them about face unlock. And then they said, but a Pixel 8 can't do face unlock, so you're not really getting 7 years of support, of software support. That nuance is sort of lost on that individual, and you know that you're never really going to have a meaningful tech interaction with that person because they're doing such a poor job of purposely misunderstanding how all this stuff works just so that they can be angry at Google. We have a lot that we should be angry with Google about. But I feel like the Gemini Nano situation is one where we've done a miserable job of not only educating consumers, but of also educating techies on how this stuff really works. We're trying to blur it so that it just looks like this magical, seamless thing that just happens. And it just works. It's got an it just works quotient of 93. Isn't that the best it just works quotient? I just made that up. But I feel like there's probably a suit in a boardroom somewhere who's trying to say something like that. So, I don't know what other people feel is happening with the Gemini Nano situation, but to me, this is a failure on two fronts for consumer education and of Google continuously rebranding and experimenting and tinkering while saying that these are products and services that are ready for the mainstream and then changing like the name of the product or changing how the service interacts. I am a little disappointed in the Tensor strategy now because Tensor was sold to us in part, not in total, but just a part of this conversation helped sort of a feeling that Google was making this transition to their own chip because they couldn't get what they wanted out of Qualcomm, right? But if what they wanted, and in part what they wanted, they named their chip Tensor, right? Like what we talk about, like, AI tools and processing and GPUs, the Tensor doesn't seem to be delivering better on-device neural processing or machine learning or LLM support as compared to MediaTek and Qualcomm. So it kind of waters down what I felt was going to be the exciting push. When we started seeing what the neural core processing could do on a Pixel 4, immediately you think, like, well, what if Google just made their own chip? They're so good at doing this kind of design and optimizing their own hardware for their own services. But then, like, we see sort of the aesthetic marketing of Circle to Search. Think about how many people were just like, oh my gosh, this is like so great. This is such a huge step forward. And it's no longer the clumsy screenshot search. And it's so elegant. And you're like, yeah, but it's still just like a visual search. You've helped highlight, yeah, I can search for this, but it's still mostly just sending this information up to a server. The server looks at what you circled and then tries to come up with meaningful comparisons that it scoured the internet for. And then I pick up a OnePlus 12, and here, let me just do it. Let me just find some random photo on my OnePlus 12. Something that I cannot do on a Pixel unless I have a cloud connection. So, oh, actually, I did this with this little, like, lizard. So I have a photo, and you just long press. Oh, it's not doing that because I already did the long press on that one. Sorry, that was a terrible example. Terrible example. Juan's failing at demonstrating this. Okay, snail shell in a field, and I just do that, and it detected the snail shell, and it's properly outlined it, and I can long press on it, drag on it, move it over to a little photo doc, and then I can move that into any other photo app or editing software, and it's great. I can't do something like that on a Pixel unless I upload it to the cloud. And then, yeah, I do have some magic editor tools that are kind of neat. Like, I can move the snail shell and it'll do a content-aware fill, but that's server-side. That's not something that you needed a Tensor chip to do. Because I can also do that from my OnePlus 12 and have, if I'm paying for Google One, I can also get those same tools and I can do that same thing. So it feels like we haven't gotten the realization of the promise that Google made when they started making all of these changes to doing their own chips and making their own services and talking about AI as this monumental shift in the consumer relationship experience. I think that that is really frustrating. But it's also like tempered by the fact that a bunch of tryhards are now like, see, Google always fails at everything. The Pixel 8's garbage. And you're like, nah. Now, I think this is a poor look for Gemini, but it doesn't really change anything about how I would recommend a Pixel 8 to my family and friends. All right, let's catch up on these comments here, and then we should probably start wrapping all this up, looking at bowing out. Before my voice completely does totally fail. Aditi Anil, everyone should be. I gotta follow Michelle on Mastodon. Man is a treasure trove of open source knowledge. And also, like, show him a little love off of Twitter. Like, no one should be on Twitter. Twitter is a miserable dumpster fire of raging proportions. And get away from it. It's bad, and it's bad for you. Yeah, Nick Gay, the Pixel 8 is dead is so dumb. The Tensor is barely used right now because a lot is sent to the cloud anyway. If the Pixel 8 uses the cloud, then from a feature standpoint, you may not lose much. And this is what we need to see. I think the big fight over the next couple of years is going to be generative AI in the cloud versus gen AI tools on device. MediaTek just showed off a whole new series of APKs they're handing out to developers that are all on device content and image generating plugin tools. All working directly on the Dimensity 9300. I actually think it will be supporting the 8300 too, but I'm not sure if it'll have the same capabilities, or if it does, it just maybe it's a slower MPU. I don't know. I have to look that up. But I think the medium to long-term investment that all of these companies are pouring cash into these massive data centers that are soaking up, eating up, insane amounts of electricity to power mediocre results to search queries, I think is kind of a losing business model. Because I also think when we look at China and India, major sections of the tech consuming market aren't going to have access to fast enough data connections to utilize cloud-based AI. So they're going to turn increasingly to on-device, and then those capabilities are going to get better, and then they're going to spread through the EU. And that's what I want is, maybe you have a data center that helps train your language learning model, but then it just updates a component in my chip, which then there's a black box of the data on my phone that the LLM can relate to, and then I have a more personal relationship with my phone. We already do that with the Google keyboard. The Google keyboard a while back, shifted up how its library and its dictionary are handled. And now that's all on device. It doesn't send this information up and down to a cloud to influence future Google keyboard behavior unless you check all the please use my information to help our apps boxes when you set up your phone. But that to me is that needs to happen. When you use the speech to text transcription on Android devices, that happens on the device now. That happens it doesn't go up to a cloud. Like, I take a video of my daughter and she's talking about something and I get real-time captioning based on what she's saying, and it's pretty accurate. That's an on-device solution. And that's what I think the future of AI is really going to look like. So if a company is spending tons and tons and tons of money to make all of these cloud tools today, I don't know that that investment is a very smart one looking at the medium term. I think it actually could blow up in a lot of companies' faces, because the cloud tool is never going to be as, I mean, look at Video Boost. The cloud tool is never going to be as accessible, as convenient, as seamless as just being able to do the thing on the phone. And there's no reason why the phone couldn't do Video Boost on the phone, just showing you a processing window, that it's chewing up that video data and spitting out a result. It's kind of the same. You've got to upload it, wait for it, and then it comes down at some time when the server isn't too busy to do the video boost. It makes no sense to me to pin those kinds of features on cloud interaction. Simon says, Hypno, I'm waiting for Gemini Pro Mini Ultra Nano. Simon says, Hypno, Pixel 8 is dead, but Pixel Fold is deader. You don't even have circle to search on the Pixel Fold. What a fail, Google. That is kind of annoying, though. DTNO, 4K video upload is not a simple task. Cellular network data speeds ain't that fast. 4K videos with H.264 compression, still surprisingly large. HEVC is a different story. But even HEVC, I know a lot of people are probably uploading little snippets, but like, try and upload 2 minutes of 4K video, even in HEVC compression. That is not a light task. And I know I'm definitely being persnickety because I'm currently not paying for unlimited data. I switched over to Mint. It is rare that I go over 10 gigs a month, so I switched down to a 15 gig per month yearly plan with Mint. My cell phone bill is ridiculously low. If you go to somegadgetguy.com, you can click on Mint, on a Mint affiliate link if you'd like to support the show that way, and we both get like a perk or a benefit for you clicking on that link to support. But like, I spend so much less money on 15 gigs a month than I was on, before that I was on Google Fi, and before that I was on T-Mobile proper. But a T-Mobile plan anywhere close to what I kind of do with Mint is so much more expensive. But even then, I would not be wanting to upload the quantity of 4K video, even in HEVC, that I shoot. It is just way too much content to shove up a pipe. So I would have to wait until I got home on Wi-Fi to know that I had a consistent upload speed. It's just so dumb. I really don't get it. And then I did my Pixel 8 camera deep dive. In the middle of my Pixel 8 camera deep dive, I took a sample of video that was shot using Video Boost, and I did my own edits in LumaFusion. Not in DaVinci Resolve, not in Adobe Premiere, in LumaFusion on the Pixel 8. And my ability to not only match, but I think I got a better video look out of LumaFusion than what Video Boost sent back down. The entire process of putting the video in a LumaFusion timeline, doing some tweaks to the levels and the edits that I made, and then re-rendering at a much higher quality than what Video Boost sends back to you, was faster than me uploading the video to Video Boost and waiting for Google to process it and then send it back down to my phone. It is not some kind of AI magic. It's a series of LUTs and noise reduction plugins. That's all Video Boost is. It's very easy to see, oh, well, they're doing this, they're boosting that, and then they're kind of whittling this down. So I think people should be shooting Video Boost videos on their Pixels, not because of the output that you get from the cloud, but because Video Boost depends on you shooting a really flat, unprocessed video that then gets sent up to Google servers. So if you shoot the Video Boost version, you start with kind of a log-style, higher bit rate, larger video sample. In fact, it's larger than 4K video. It's not 3840. So you should do that and then edit it yourself, and it's probably faster and better than what Video Boost can do for you. Let's see. Oh, Muppinish, did you take up the Apple EU fine of $1 billion? We talked about that. Did we talk about it 2 weeks ago? I know I've been talking about it somewhere. I genuinely don't remember. It was a nice step. It's also important to note that it will only take Apple about 9 days to make up the profit, not the revenue, the profit to pay off that $1 billion fine. So I'm sure they totally learned their lesson on 10 years of services doing terrible things in anti-competitive ways, and they'll never do anything like that ever again if that's the only kind of fine that they face for a 10-year investigation in how they did business with Spotify. Nope. Justice has been served. Anyway, Nick Gay, I'm still waiting for someone to prove to me that Tensor wasn't an experiment to get ahead of its own AI to see what was sellable. I feel Tensor was also a targeted move against Qualcomm licensing, because I feel like now that Google is making this promise for 7 years of software support, one of the main reasons is they control the chip. So they don't have to pay another company for extended software licensing or support. They own it. So I think the Tensor benefit is more like when you say, hey, are you going to recommend Pixel 8? My wife uses a Pixel 8. This is one of the best phones she's ever used. I'm very confident it's going to get 7 years of Android patches and Android updates. I don't care about all the feature improvements because those change year to year with hardware. I just want to know that she's got a good path for getting security patches and bug fixes. That's all we really cared about in kind of doing the Pixel. But I feel like the reason why they're doing that is because now they save money on controlling the ecosystem for their software and support. Samsung is in a different position where they could probably afford to pay more of those licensing fees. And as Samsung has increased the windows on software support, that has come with correlating increases in prices, even if the rest of the hardware of the phone is only minimally changed. I think it is correct that if Samsung is offering 7 years of software support instead of five, that's probably a chunk of the $100 price increase we saw on Samsung phones. So to me, that was more a can we control our own destiny move more than do we really have the best AI solution. I was hoping we would see a more disruptive chip design from Google, but partnering with Samsung, we were never going to get the full impact of that, unfortunately. Maybe a Tensor 5 with TSMC backing them can show us something a bit more aggressive. We just got to now wait a whole other product cycle to see if that can play out. Yeah, Barry, same thing, man. I wish Google could somehow partner with MediaTek, but the partnership isn't with chip design as much as it is with chip fab. So Google going to TSMC means that they will be making their own chip design even more separated from Samsung and Exynos components. But I think they're ready to do that. So going to MediaTek, they might get some partnership in design, but MediaTek doesn't run their own fab. So then what do? You still need to go to an Intel or to a TSMC to get the chip actually printed. And TSMC is going to be able to work with them on ARM reference designs if they use like ARM reference cores. So instead of the Exynos badge on that, it's just going to be an ARM reference core that gets put into that chip design. It's not as plug and play and as simple Lego block as I'm making it sound, but I feel like what they could have done with MediaTek is a lot more limited than just going directly to TSMC. What I'll be curious to see is who does Google turn to for the radio? And that's something where MediaTek could make a big play in the United States. A MediaTek radio would be better performance and better power efficiency than a Samsung radio, and it would keep Google from needing to license Qualcomm technologies. So that's the one area where I think MediaTek could make a difference in a future Pixel. I don't think it will work for their CPU or GPU designs. Aditya, no, it's a little bit more complicated than that. So in theory, those LUTs and presets could just be downloaded as a preset should a creative person be so inclined. I think the only thing that is cloud-y about the edits that are happening are what decisions are being made. So to me, this is like, you do video boost during the daytime, and you're seeing this information come from a log-like flatter video, and then a server says, well, we're going to lift this and drop this and do that. And that is very similar to what HDR processing is already happening on your phone. It makes a different decision based on the subject, the lighting environment, the type of metering that you select. Our cameras already do this in processing the final JPEG or the final MP4. But when you start with a raw piece of video, you don't want to just slap a one-size-fits-all LUT on everything that you shoot. You really want to look, hey, in this scene, in these lighting conditions, with this color tone and this palette, I really want to make these kinds of decisions. So I think it's really just easier, instead of saying, hey, there's a preset, you do this preset, all your video is going to look great, is just to look. I mean, like, do I need to turn up the gamma? You know, actually, I could turn down the saturation and do this with the brightness. Like, you can make a really fast decision in the moment. And I'm talking about doing it in LumaFusion. Let me see if I still have the project. All of my samples were nighttime too. So that also helped abbreviate. Yeah, it's actually like the first project that shows up where I just clip by clip, I did all the clips in one timeline. And if you caught my video boost, I don't want to show my wife's texts on camera. But if you saw, I did just a before and after comparison on video boost. The before videos are log, they're flat. And a bunch of people are like, oh man, pixels take such terrible video, but video boost looks amazing. And you're like, no, that is not what video looks like from a pixel. When you do video boost, it is purposely capturing a flatter image so that then you can send it up and juice up all of these colors and contrast. The only difference is LumaFusion doesn't have a great noise reduction. They don't have any noise reduction plugin that I know of. But I actually kind of like the grainier look because that helps preserve more detail. When you send that video up to Video Boost and it gets smoothed out, like I've got Christmas tree video that doesn't look as good because the tree just looks smeary and plasticky because it can't delineate the difference between noise in the video and like the subtle movements of my hands and all of the tree branches and little ornaments and things like that. So all of that just gets kind of like Vaseline'd, and I don't think that looks as good. So again, why I front an app like LumaFusion so much is because you can very quickly dial in the look on something, boost brightness, juice up the color, desaturate, turn something black and white. They just updated all of their transitions. Their transitions are amazing. So some really, really good stuff in there. And I paid for the app once and I haven't spent another nickel. It's not a subscription. It's not some kind of yearly renewal or monthly fee. It's really good. And I'm not an experienced color grader. I can very quickly make up the difference between video boost and regular video. So anyway, we're going to finish this up where we almost hit 3 hours. I'm so disappointed in myself. I'm going to take one more drink of water. Folks, I'm bailing on this podcast pretty quick. I have loved this conversation. We came back to some heavy-hitting news. I still have some plans at the end of March to try and shake up, maybe not do a full-on pajama podcast because we started March off with me needing to take a break, but maybe trying to do a bit of a town hall for our last podcast of March, something where we can have people contributing to the conversation or just shaking things up in a fun way. So we'll see if I can pull that off. But we've got tons of stuff coming out. I've got a video on some crazy phones, some new wireless microphones, wrapping up a very difficult video that I'm shooting on a laptop that came sent to me with malware pre-installed. There's some stuff. There's some stuff going on. And we're running headlong into sort of the early teases for what's going to be announced leading into summer and back to school. This year is so aggressively ahead of schedule. I'll be curious to see like where we end up, because there are already people talking about rumors for Snapdragon 8 Gen 4 and Dimensity 9400. So it's a lot. This is really, really, really crazy stuff. So I want everybody here to have a fantastic week. I have to shout a fanfare of glory to Muppinish gifting a tier one sub to Kapakosh. That fanfare of glory, as provided by one Mr. Barry Johnson for hooking me up with the Stream Deck. Thank you so much for supporting production on this channel, and I really appreciate all the folks who not only come here every week and nerd out on obscure tech news stories and politics and stuff, but then also, like, we need to be the good resources for our family and friends. Lately, especially across social media, we need to be the good resources for people who think they're tech enthusiasts. So, have a fantastic week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I'll catch you back here next Monday for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Be safe. Take care of yourselves so you can keep taking care of others. And I'll catch you back. I love you all.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.